Madam Madi Jing Nalin, Chief Director in the Communal Policy and Planning. Sam Hatle, Director Local Government. Conrad Babatin, Director Local Government. Now, our discussion really is about dealing with this thing called the detail is in the devil. Most of the time we're dealing with the broad frameworks. And so today we shall be dealing with the detail in the devil in respect of municipal budget and reporting regulation. It's a thick document. Going to be able to give us the most critical highlights and we take it from there. I think this is a very useful piece of work that would really ensure that we start getting our grips on what's going on in respect of the MFMA, if you like. We've been talking to municipalities about MFMA for such a long time without the benefit of this detail. And so here we are today dealing with that. And I'm sure it's going to disappoint people because I'm told on the program it's the FAPL, and I suspect that's what people are expecting to hear us talking about. It's not the FAPL. It's the regulation. I'm talking about the gentlemen that are walking in now. It's about the Local Government Municipal Finance Management Act, Municipal Budget and Reporting Regulations, not the FAPL. I can already see some disappointments. Over to you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and members. It is always a privilege for us to be here to share some of our work and to also basically get your input and approval for some of the stuff that we're doing. Now, whilst they're loading some of the presentations, maybe just a bit of background. Importantly, we need to look at municipalities and their functions and responsibilities and basically ask ourselves what is it that they do before we actually get even to the point as to how do we finance them. Now, municipalities, in the main, they deliver basic services, not only to the poor, but to every citizen within its jurisdiction in there. Then municipalities as well are the engines of growth, actually, within our country. So if our municipalities are not functioning optimally, then actually they are failing. But if we look at it from a broader perspective, municipalities, to be able to fulfill their role, need infrastructure, for example, which is one of the main important inputs that you actually need, basically, in there. Then, because if you talk about water, you first need to have the infrastructure before you have the water. If you talk about electricity, you first need the infrastructure, regulation, infrastructure in municipalities to be able to get the service. And so you can go with everything. Before a business actually even thinks of opening up a business, the township needs to be established for a business, it needs to be zoned for a business, the infrastructure to support the business must be in place in there. So there you've got a big role, basically, which underpins everything that the municipality does, and it is how it plans for its infrastructure and how it enrolls it out. Now, why do I start there? Because Jan will be presenting and Madi Jung will also talk about has got to do how then does municipalities, given the IDPs, the strategic plans and everything, then put a budget together that is coherent and that can support the objectives of that particular municipality there. And the regulations that we are about to discuss are going to say how do we then streamline basically all of it. So that firstly to support the municipality, but also for the benefit of our legislatures, councils, parliament. information to do that, it makes it rather difficult to hold them accountable. Now, the regulations as a start may be looking quite at the financial aspects of things as a start, but we are rolling out actually aggressively also on the non-financial side how we can get information in a very coherent way to be able to roll out quite a bit of that. Then, another very important aspect and why we are here is we've got 283 municipalities. In fact, you've got 283 municipalities that are running on 283 different systems, for example. Now, clearly, if you want to know how our municipality is performing, say, in the water sector, it means we need to get to 283 systems to get an aggregate picture on how performance is, for example, on the water side. Right? Now, it becomes quite a tedious process. Now, we have succeeded in the past 2-3 years in improving quite extensively our financial information, and the local government budget and expenditure review that we've published is testament to the quality improvement of our information. And we think we can still go far beyond that. Right? Now, these regulations are going to put us actually in that far beyond that we want to be in there. Now, with your permission, Honorable Chair, if you can remember, before the Budget Council, we had quite a bit of a discussion on infrastructure financing. And then I indicated that we may want to come and do a presentation on infrastructure, because there's a relationship between infrastructure and how these budgets, IDPs, and all of that are couched. So we've got hard copies. I think let's not be delayed. And then Madi Jen can run through those particular articles, just 20 slides, not going to be long, and then we can get a few questions and then enter into the heart of the discussion that then links up to this particular one. Marjane?
Do you have the copies?
No, not that one. There's another one.
Thank you, Chair. I think what we want to share with you here is the thinking that we have in order to try to address some of the problems that we have been identified that has hampered our ability as government to achieve the kind of outcomes and outputs that we expect from the spending. I think the biggest issue now in government is how can we use this fiscal instrument that we have to accelerate service delivery. I think what we are looking here is how we are proposing, with the approval of Cabinet also, the changes that we want to implement in NIC in order to accelerate and fast-track eradication of backlogs, which... So I think in the first slide, the second slide, by way of a background, if you look at NIC, it's a major funding instrument for municipal infrastructure to eradicate backlog. I think it was created out of many grants, about 8 grants that were consolidated into NIC, which was able to enable municipalities to begin to take proper control of their planning and budgeting in an integrated way, in order to address some of the problems of fragmentation that were existing when there were so many grants. So the grant itself has enhanced certainty in terms of the flow, because the allocations are made on a 3-year basis, and municipalities would know upfront what is flowing to them. But I think there has been problems that we have identified which have resulted in us getting less than optimal outcomes that we could get. Some of the problems relate to capacity of the municipalities, the planning and asset management practices, the inefficiencies that arises because of misalignment between the grants, the funding limitations that we have. And I think the issue is moving forward, how can we be able to address some of these problems and unblock some of the blockages in the system that have so far undermined our pace of delivery of infrastructure. I think that is where we are saying that now this calls for another phase of reform on NIC that will look at how we can accelerate eradication while we also foster improved real impacts through greater integration at the local level. And I think this in itself says to us we need to look at the differences in municipalities. Because when we introduced NIC, the assumption was that all municipalities are at the same level. And yet municipalities differ in terms of their capacity, technical capacity, their financial capacity, and the migration patterns, and all that drivers of backlogs. The profile is different. So how do you use the same instruments in the same way to achieve the results in different contexts? So I think also what is very clear is that when you look at the cities, they need to balance economic growth and basic services and new infrastructure with rehabilitation. So they have got to be able to strike appropriate balance in that. And I think failure to do that is manifested by failure of the infrastructure that is critical for the cities and the economies to actually operate. So they have to, and we need to be able to acknowledge that. I think also the poorest municipalities also, we need to recognize that they are poorly resourced. They need a greater support in terms of delivery. I think when we look at this, the next slide really talks to the kind of differences that we already have noted. I think when we looked at the local government review, that migration is happening and it's happening to the city, so that you've got more poor people that are coming into the cities at the end. But on the other hand, the cities are key in terms of economic growth. So we have to be able to put them in a position where they will maintain and still be able to keep pace with the rate in which they have to provide infrastructure to facilitate economic growth, which also is key to eradication of poverty. But the last slide also shows that the kind of profile of backlog is different. The city's major backlog is driven by housing needs, whereas in the rest of them, you've got service delivery backlog. So how do you begin to address this in a manner that actually works, taking into consideration those two differences? And the third slide really shows that these challenges would create a need, therefore, to make sure that the cities are able to focus reduction of poverty and growth in their assets. Because when you look at the first slide, it says that the rate at which they're investing is actually not at par with the rate in which we are, for instance, investing in the development in these urban cities, which means that they are falling behind in terms of supplying water, electricity, and roads into these developments that are actually key in terms of these cities. There's a problem in terms of maintenance. I think the last piece of the slide shows that the cities, another problem is that they are not able to actually be in control in terms of fully in the decisions that actually impact on the outcomes of the built environment, because the greater percentage, almost 70-75% of what is being invested in these cities actually is managed by either provincial or national government or the entities, which therefore means that to create integrated cities becomes quite a major challenge.
The next slide, let me just quickly explain the next two slides. Let's take the one that shows the yellow parts of it. That is an area of view, in a way, of say Gauteng, where we've got our three metros. Alright? And it shows basically population per square meter. So the high rises will show the denseness of a particular area. That if you take, for example, Mabopane, alright, you'll see there's a bit of densification on the Mabopane side. If you go to Joburg, you're going to see quite a bit of densification because of those high rises that shows there. Then you go to Soweto, you see a bit of densification in there. Now take Mamelodi and Ettridgeville. So where you've got our communities actually staying, but between the two, you've got the city of Pretoria. Tshwane itself, the city. Right? And you can see the city is not that dense, not that densified. Now, if you look at this entire map along those lines, you realize where are the poor people mainly staying? In Mabopane, which is far from the city, which means they must commute into the city and back. You take Ettridgeville, you take Mamelodi, and so you can go. You take on the Joburg side, you go towards Annandale, Sebokeng, Everton, and all of those areas. Then you start to see densification in that. All right. Now let's take and we do the same actually on the Ikurhuleni side, where the densifications are just don't make sense. So at the end of the day, what you have, how the cities are then planned in a way. They are not planned to foster the kind of integration in terms of getting people to stay very closer to economic activity so that they can get the benefits of that economic activity. If you think about it, if you stay in Everton and you work in Johannesburg, it costs you roughly about 50 rand just to go to work and back, right? And if you multiply that by the number of working days, you'll find that the person is spending close to 1,000 rand just to go to work and back. And who are the people who are staying there? Are the people who are possibly earning 2,500, 3,000 rand. So at the end of the day, nearly a third of their spending is just to get to work and back there. So now that's the one part of it. Now, there's an inefficiency that goes with it as well. Government must roll out certain infrastructure for the people, whether it's roads, whether it's electricity, for water and all of that. Because of how our communities have been spread out, the cost of them providing it, it becomes also quite an added burden, basically, for the state itself, and for that matter, for the ratepayers and the people who pay for services within that. Right. Now, what we are saying is, why we want to then differentiate? We want to differentiate so that we can start to influence these spatial patterns. The OECD report actually made quite a startling finding, actually, where it said one thing that South Africa succeeded in was to roll out, I mean, to house its people. If you think about over 2.5 million people that were housed low cost. All right? But one thing that South Africa didn't succeed in, and something that South Africa must work on very hardly, has got to do with apartheid spatial patterns. And how do we really break its back? And this is the approach. If you go to the next slide underneath, and you start to compare how world cities are structured, you're going to see there's a center where there's densification. If you take say London, for example, with a population of about 7 million people, right, you've got densification right in the center of London where people can migrate, and the transport systems are quite efficient to be able to manage that kind of densification. People who then live on the outskirts are people who can afford to get into their cars and then drive into the city. So you go, and if you look at Paris, it's the same thing. Now, if you look at Gauteng at the bottom and you compare it, Gauteng as a province is bad, and it's the smallest province in the country, right? But if you start to look at even the three metros within Gauteng, then you can see the disjointedness, basically, of it. And this is where we start off and say, but we need to change tech in how we finance infrastructure there, because I think how we finance infrastructure leads to what we see in that picture.
So I think that those are the challenges of the cities, to say that we have spent so much money, but the kind of spatial patterns that we have are not consistent with economic growth and poverty alleviation, because the poor remain poor and very far from economic activities. And I think as long as the cities still have to comply with different kinds of grant requirements, the incentive to begin to put people right there and perpetuate this spatial pattern will still continue. Therefore, we are saying then we need to change tech. But on the other hand, with regards to the rural municipalities, the issue is about expanding access to these services in a sustainable way. So this therefore begs the need to look at how do you actually look at capacity. And the kind of capacity solution also will be different, because there are some of these municipalities that clearly will never be able to have the kind of capacity they need. And maybe they don't actually need that capacity to stay there. But what is the strategy that you need to look at? Some municipalities can attract capacity, and how do you begin to address that? So the issue is then how do they get to a sustainable level of service, and in a manner in which that we manage the subsidies. So I think when you look at further the issues around the metros in the eighth slide, is that the major capital spending occurs in the metros, if you have to look at it, but they rely less on NIC compared to the rest of the municipalities. Therefore, it means that if we really want, yes. Oh, now I am on slide 8. Slide 8. Yeah. So in slide 8, it really just shows expenditure patterns of these different categories of municipalities showing that although metros are so, six metros, they account for quite great proportion. But on the one hand, their dependence on NIC is very limited compared to the other municipalities. So what means that if we want to achieve the kind of outcomes and output that we want to achieve in terms of eradication of the backlogs, we cannot say the grants would be the major source. Their own funding and other funding opportunity that will be created need to be looked at in terms of how they can actually be leveraged to make sure that government can achieve this eradication of backlogs. I think that the next backlog, 9, just shows the expenditure, you know, patterns and the performance in NIC. The next slide, 10, therefore motivates for differentiated approach. And I think we are saying that this funding difference that we need to make to these categories of municipality need to recognize that in the urban area there's a growing problem of access to basic services because of the inward migration that is happening. But these services, because of the informal settlement nature of the backlogs that are there, we therefore need also a housing solution, needs these cities to coordinate their investment in an integrated way in order to achieve the built environment outcome. And remember, the built environment outcome that you're looking for is that you've got better integration, better densification that will allow better transport systems that will be suitable for the poor, which is not what is happening at the moment. So we need to begin to strengthen and strengthen the healthy, sustainable communities, and to make sure that instead of focusing on projects when we deal with these big cities, we really focus on whether they're achieving the outcomes and outputs, you know. So, but on the other hand, with regard to the rural municipalities, which is also on the other end, which lacks services, we need also to begin to realize that the issues of capacity need to be strengthened. And this would require some form of partnerships, strengthening partnership even with communities to make sure that they can take charge of some of these responsibilities, which we believe that is something that perhaps we haven't made use of effectively. So the next slide number 11, is the proposal in terms of the allocation mechanism to the big cities. So what we are saying is that therefore the NIC grant, you would have the two pots in the NIC grant, one for the cities, that will therefore have its own grant framework and grant conditions. The conditions will therefore respond to the challenges of the municipalities and begin to look at greater need for greater integration in the planning and also at the national level in terms of the different funding instruments. While in the lower municipalities, the issue is how do we unlock the capacity to actually deliver in a sustainable way. That is the big issue. So the focus on rural municipalities, that is slide number 12, the target therefore would be on, to ensure that the sectors would want to play a greater role. And I think one of the things that was being talked about is the possibility of ring fencing for water, particularly sanitation and the rural sanitation, which can actually be eradicated quickly. And also to make sure that greater development bias is created, because I think we believe that in the rural areas, the need may not necessarily so much housing, but the need is the issue of livelihoods. So how do you begin to leverage and make sure that things like that actually works in an integration? And that is the level of integration that we are talking about in that area. So the need, therefore, here is to step up infrastructure capacity to make sure that we can deliver and deliver faster. So with regard to the NIC in the intermediate municipalities, because obviously when we talk about the big cities, that's slide number 13. Within this other group, there's different categories. So I have talked about the most rural. So we can talk about the metro, the intermediate municipalities, where we are saying here you need to encourage the evolution of the investment strategies and make sure that they can actually be allowed to grow into the NIC for cities. Because what we are looking at from NIC for cities is that we'll start with the metros, and then this will grow into the 21 big cities that we have in the moment. So the NIC for cities, therefore, will focus more on the output and outcome of the entire budget, not just the grant. And remember, the grant account for about 10%. And then what we are reaching for is how do we then begin to look at the entire budget and see how it is being prioritized in a manner that allows the country to achieve the kind of outcome that we achieve. So the issue is to support cities to integrate the built environment investment. How do they and how are they able to integrate their investment in transport system, in housing, and infrastructure in order actually to achieve efficiencies? Because if you have housing too far from the infrastructure, the cost of that is huge. The cost of transportation is huge. So how do they begin to build in that? And if they don't have flexibility in terms of how they plan, then it becomes a big issue. So the issue also is to allow them to make local appropriate trade-offs, because they know that they are going to either benefit from the economic spin-off, and also the cost of operating, they are going to bear the cost. So they should be able to make those trade-offs. And then one of the things that we are saying is that we need to recognize that these cities do have relatively considerable capacity to deliver. So this capacity, which they can spend and do so responsibly once you strengthen accountability, but also the ability to respond to the national to the local needs in this case. So I think that's really the focus in terms of the need for cities. So the big thing, therefore, is about the shift from inputs monitoring, like monitoring of projects, but to actually building partnership with these cities. Because, I mean, if we are going to say we are looking at the whole budget, we are never going to just impose on them. We've got to be able to build the sustainable partnership and begin to achieve understanding of their context and their issues, and then they begin to understand where government is. So that at the end of the day, we are able to engage with them and have a shared understanding of the manner in which things need to happen. So what we are looking at in the next slide 15, is the kind of outcomes and outputs that this grant would be looking at, you know, based on the entire budget of the capital budget of the municipalities. I think some of the issues that are still outstanding that we're still looking at is how we then look at integrating with our transport grant, our NTPG grant, to begin to, because those are part of what makes the built environment. But we are looking at the four major outcomes. That we are saying that in their budgets, we want to see that they approach the priority to combat poverty. That means universalizing access to basic services should be there, job creation, making sure that investment coordination in the built environment is sensible, and making sure that also they are supporting growth. That's the second one. Which means that, therefore, they need to make sure that the infrastructure that supports growth is well maintained, is well upgraded, is well kept. So the asset management practices will want to be able to make sure. So that kind of a balance between new, rehab, and maintenance, we need to be able to make sure. Sustainability of service delivery. What is the point of having pipes when they can't bring out water? So we need to be able to make sure that they can do that. And the issue of accountability of and governance are part of the things that we want to see, and we are linking this with the budget reforms that we are implementing. So for cities to be eligible, there are conditions, you know, for them to do. So we want to see a good track record on expenditure patterns. We also want to see a good track record and good governance. I think the issues around the budget reforms, about the audit outcomes, are issues that we have. The issues around partnership that we are building. It's slide number 17. So I'm going to slide number 18 now. So what are we looking for in terms of the MIG for cities? We are looking at the pro-poor budgets, not for just for MIG. We are looking at strategic investment selection that delivers integrated development outcomes. Not just spending, chasing projects, but we want to see changes in development outcomes that we are talking about. And what will this deliver is that an ongoing strategic engagement with the major cities. So we are not going to keep arm's length in terms of the broader picture of what needs to happen. And stronger and more integrated investment pipelines that can deliver a scale. So when there's certainty in terms of the flow and the understanding in terms of the planning, there's going to be better planning. And then shorter project lead times and improved development outcomes, moreover. So in terms of implementing differentiated approach, what we are doing is we are separating MIG into two components for cities and for the rest, and we have got two grant frameworks, one that talks to the cities and one that talks to the rest of the municipalities. And for the cities, the big emphasis is around focusing on the outputs and outcomes. And then we are looking at phased implementation, starting with the 6 metros and then increasing to the 21 cities, which we are going to be working with in the next 2 years. So, and those are the issues around it. So in terms of the way forward, we have got an approval of cabinet to continue, and these issues are already captured in the Division of Revenue. There has been quite an extensive consultation with stakeholders, and I think there's quite an agreement in terms of the understanding of the problem, the understanding of the approach. I think some of the issues that we still need to resolve are the issues around how do you actually begin to report in an appropriate way. And I think the concerns there is around the multiple reporting requirements that we require at the moment. And it's like, how do you then begin to streamline in a manner that will make sure that we get the right kind of information that will tell us the right picture without actually burdening the municipalities. So that is something that we are still working on to resolve with the rest of the stakeholders.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. There you have it on the infrastructure side. Jan, later on when he talks in his presentation, we'll talk about then how do these cities in the budget statements and budget formats start to actually to prepare capital budgets, for example, to that. He will briefly talk to that later on in the presentation. I don't know whether you want us to stop, have a short engagement.
Let's do have a short engagement. Because you see, where I'm seated, I have my own reservations. I'm not going to raise them for now, but in terms of, I agree with the principle that this one size fits all is problematic. But I think we still have to come back. You see, there's a big issue that you seem to want to run away from now, and which I think we ourselves have been trying to espouse big time when we've been engaging with the municipalities. And that was to, if you're studying, for instance, to say there's this special MIG package for metros. When in our mind we thought that, for instance, metros have borrowing powers. Now they've got huge budgets, they've got revenue and so on. Because we wanted to unlock MIG, the equitable share, to the rural and poor. As I'm saying, there's this one step forward and two steps backward kind of approach, which does worry me and does create this reservation. When in fact we should be dealing with metros in such a manner that they become more efficient, both in planning, etc., such that they then use the borrowing power. Well, what's the use of the borrowing power if we continue with the MIG and so on? I'm just saying that's my own reservation for now. I have many. Let me allow my colleagues then to engage with you on this one. I'll come back a bit later just to raise some of the matters. Ms. Robinson, Mr. Sokoni.
Thank you, Chair. I agree with you that I'm happy to see that we're moving away from one-size-fits-all mentality, because that has been a major stumbling block through all aspects of government. So that is a step forward. But I'm just wondering, and perhaps this is not quite fair to ask you, but I'm going to raise it anyway, what are we doing about the skill and the competence of the administrators, people who are going to be doing this, and adherence to proper governance? As I was driving in this morning, I heard about a municipal manager who had been dismissed in a somewhat strange manner. It seemed as though it had all been cut and dried. And, you know, there is mismanagement at all levels. I think that's one of our major stumbling blocks, too. Is there anything being done to address that?
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson, and maybe we appreciate the input from Treasury. But I think that I also add my voice on what you have said. I have here underlined on slide 2 the one bullet that says cities need to balance economic and basic services, new infrastructure with rehabilitation. I mean, if you say that is a reserve for, I mean, to me, this, if I simple, my simple interpretation of this statement seems to be saying these needs are the needs for the cities. The other municipalities, the local municipalities, they shouldn't worry much about economic growth at their own municipalities where unemployment is rife. That's why we're talking about, I'm saying the statement, the way it was occurred, it reflects, it gives that impression. And to me, the reason why we're having this informal settlement across the airport is because of your apartheid, what you call a special planning, which really did not focus on growing the economy there in the rural areas, but focus on saying, let's grow Cape Town, let's grow Johannesburg and Durban. Everybody flocks there. When there's now, today, there's no employment in Johannesburg or Durban or Cape Town. Now people are creating what you call informal, and saying the way it is crafted, so it's a the impression that it is conveying, it's not sending the message perhaps that it is intended. And clearly, maybe we should, what you call it, send the message that says there is a need there at the local municipality. And I think what the chairperson is saying is that, and partly Ms. Robinson is talking about in terms of the skills, is perhaps the other challenge that National Treasurer is having in terms of desegregating this municipal infrastructure grant is also, even if you give so much in the Mzimvubu municipality or a port or Alfred Nzo, but again, those who are to call the funds may remain unused because there is no skill, but maybe the skills are not there for ensuring that they are used. But the need for really improving infrastructure is dire there, and I think that what the National Treasury says about the way your special distribution of population stands. Sure. Well, I'm not sure if we're going to be able to change that, but I think the challenge that we're facing is how do you ensure that for the person in Mabopane, Mamelodi, does not spend so much. When we cut bus subsidies, for instance, cut bus subsidies so that those people must really now dig deeper into their pockets. Those subsidies are not there for the buses. I think that is something perhaps that also needs to be explained, that how does it work? I think the chairperson has has raised the issue of the big cities. Now these cities, if you look at the budget of Johannesburg and look at some of the provinces, the whole province, Johannesburg's budget is bigger than Northern Cape, Free State, and some of the water cross. It's much bigger. And now the issue is really how do we ensure, slide, what you call 12, does talk about the skills partnerships, so design, construction, all those things. Clearly, there is a need for an integrated approach. I think that it's appreciated that National Treasury or government does take this into cognizance as we move forward. I have noted here something. Sure. Now, Chair, is it the Bulugane resolution or not the Alliance, what you call a summit, which I was talking about, this planning commission.
which is a very important thing. Maybe already we have started to implement some of these things, which is will really take us, will frog jump us if we take that approach. But the thing is, we're talking here about beginning to implement this approach in April. What is the level of planning at a municipal level, for instance? I mean, if you're going to bring the whole new embedded commerce, you know, approach to municipalities, are they ready to perhaps absorb those funds that will come? I think maybe it's just a concern, and yes. Now, thank you very much, Chairperson. So far.
Well, Mr. Sobhoni still has to run and meet some powers that be at 11 o'clock. He'll come back and join us after that. And Madam Nkunu.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Thank you so much for the presentation that we have had in the midst of outcry over service delivery. The planned program of fast-tracking delivery might be okay, but we are faced with a huge backlog in the rural areas, and that is why we think now it will be better to increase the MIGs in cities so that we say poor people can have access to better life. It can't be the case. Because once, I mean, if we are going to neglect clearing the backlog in the rural areas, it means more people coming to cities and a huge volume of people coming to cities, whereas we're not going to increase the pipes, for instance, that bring water as soon as possible. We're not going to increase the pipes that take out the effluent and everything to the seas or to the rivers right now. And we're not going to increase the capacity to shakes immediately. But there's land that is just land fallow in the rural areas which need to be helped. And people just need water, electricity mostly. Can we start by dealing with that, clearing the backlog in the rural areas? I come from a place where we've been fighting for almost 2 years. The pipes are empty, they are there, but there is no water. How do we face that? If we say then the water table is low, let us provide. Even cities, they need to have gardens to make their life better and improve their economic growth. But the water from the houses that falls is, you know, it goes to the seas instead of being harvested for the gardens. Can you look at that backlog in the rural areas, harvesting water for gardens and then sanitation? And then we can look at how we can have the big cities. I mean, it has been explained how they can, you know, collect revenues, and people are ready to invest in towns, but our poor rural people who are forced to come to towns simply because there's no way of remaining in the country. And some of the people, especially the young ones, they just come to towns to die. They are sick. There is nothing, I mean, no water to wash their themselves with their clothes.
I just wanted to check, just a clarity, point of clarity. My colleague mentioned that the bus subsidies were being cut, and we know, of course, there's been an enormous problem with the bus companies. I just wanted to check, have they been cut, or was this just a matter of inefficiency, that the money was not being made available, and that was a problem? Because I don't think we can cut subsidies at all. We need to assist, because this is one of the big problems of the workforce being so far away. And if this is a matter of inefficiency from a particular department and you, you know, being hard on them, then how can we avoid this in future?
Natasha, maybe it's good that I speak after my colleague. cutting, I'm not meaning reducing them. I just mean that they've not been paid to those people. thank you.
Yeah, Chair, I really appreciate the focus on the rural areas. You know, the first light on the first slide on the on slide 12 talks about the greater role for sectors. Madam Ngaleni at the beginning did mention that MIG is now was consolidated from different what you call small pockets of sectoral input into one. But I'm not sure if that goes with monitoring and evaluation of those what you call the sectoral roles into this into MIG. For instance, there are others who are very active. If you take DWARF, for instance, there are challenges, but they seem to be very active. But there are others who are less active. Roads. You go around. I'm not sure. The role is very unclear. In fact, what the committee has done of late, people that we, Mr. Khatla and them that we will go around the country with, they will notice that we bring everybody, all those sectors on board, each one to explain themselves. And we think that maybe going forward, this is going to be, if the, from what you call a salary side, there is a recognition for these people to play a more, what you call, a important role, I think that will achieve something from that, because of the disparities of participation from this sectoral, stakeholders. And the chairperson here can tell you is inundated with calls wherever we go. Because what the departments do, when we're there, they commit themselves. The minute we pack our bags and leave for Cape Town, they are also gone. It's packed with those kind of articles. Because the sectors are not playing the role that they are supposed to be playing. That's why I'm raising this question of, in this consolidation, it didn't go enough with monitoring and evaluation of each one of them. Thank you.
Okay, let me just raise a whole range of confusing things now. They would be surely confusing. You're raising an interesting matter of partnerships. But then you don't spell out the powers in the partnership. For instance, government would have a stronger power because they have money. Same applies to the private sector, if you like. It's a matter we've also raised with the DBSA in the context of building these partnerships. But surely communities would not have this economic muscle because they come in poor. How do we deal with that? Now I'm raising this because it is the same communities that in fact have taken a lead to address this partial apartheid planning, if you like, by just deciding to build houses next to the airport and to kind of informal settlements. I drove through, I think 2-3 weeks ago, through Nizna. Again, I've seen communities who decided to build informal settlements right next to N2. Very dangerous up the mountain, but it's about exactly this thing of building closer to work opportunities. But then the problem is, those people, firstly, are going to be dealt with brutally by the law. This place is not rezoned for whatever you're doing. You're not supposed to be here, etc., etc. This thing is planned for something else, and so on. How do we deal with those matters? I'm raising this in the context of the powers. And so legally, how do we ensure that these partnerships benefit? Firstly, in terms of ensuring that the spatial planning that you're talking about is done appropriately. But secondly, if and when communities decide to invade land, if you like, in that kind of fashion, because they want to be closer to work opportunities, how legally do we intend defending them in the context of partnerships? You see, because when these things are done, people forget this partnership thing. They call in something called Red Ants in Johannesburg, where people are just beaten up, etc., and therefore pushed away. I'm just raising that as part of the big problem. Now, secondly, whilst you are raising these matters, again, I say it's very useful. But I think there's something that we have not done, which I think is we should have started there myself. And in fact, it's something I thought we were going to do, depending on we need to check before we even go this route. For me, it would have been useful to do an audit of to what extent have everybody complied with Section 39 of DORA. 09, 10, and 11, planning of infrastructure. This infrastructure plans. I'm raising this because sometime late last year, we were told that the Eastern Cape was far back as a province in terms of complying with this. So that before we even start proposing these additional allocations, let's also be clear in terms of people, firstly, having been ready to do these things. And so whether people have been able to comply with submitting those reports that were expected as early as the 28th of June with provincial treasuries and national treasury, infrastructure plans, that is. For me, it's something that is very critical. We should have done that before we even start proposing all of these good things. Now, part of the big problem I'm coming back to in respect of the municipalities in general, all of them, again, before we even start thinking of proposing additional funds, all of them are violating Section 13, investment. Whether you're talking now a poor municipality, there's money that is sitting in the bank. Everybody is a fund manager. And for me, I think those are things that we would want to start unlocking. Now, this investment is big, very big in metros. Again, giving them this additional incentive, if you like, of the MIG. We're talking that investment plus the borrowing power. In fact, even your Rustenburg, if things are run properly, could be using the borrowing powers, etc. All of them have this investment that's sitting somewhere there. Now, there's another area. You have not done an audit on this one. It's something I picked up last week when I was briefing my province on the FAPL. I sat in a discussion that was dealing with an entity. Did you know that some entities own roads, government entities? The Free State Development Corporation owns a road. And they are saying they've been in talks with the municipalities there to take over the roads. Municipalities are not interested in Botshabelo, in Bethlehem, in Kwakwa. there are those areas where these entities have built some infrastructure, huge warehouses, etc., and the roads that run there. They claim, in fact, I've asked them to do an audit in the Free State of all the roads that are owned by that entity. Now, we're talking here, your Northwest Development Corporation surely must be owning those roads if this is true. And so when you're talking, therefore, these infrastructure issues, have we dealt with this? How do we align, again, in the context of the partnership between the community, between the entities, between the municipality? Because in that meeting, we were told that municipalities are not interested in taking over these roads, which unfortunately, therefore, have an impact on the revenue of the entity. That's what the entity was saying. They've got to dig deep to ensure that they maintain the road and so on and so on. So I'm saying part of the big issue for me is the audit, therefore, of all of these things before we even start thinking about starting throwing money around. Before we even start throwing money around, madam, so that as we deal with this division of revenue that's coming, in my view, we should have just taken a step backward, start doing all of this audit. We understand the necessity, etc., but let's just do the audit first, just to clean up all of these things. Part of what worries me is the fact that we do want to influence in the context of the Intergovernmental Relations Framework Act, but we're not talking about punitive measures for everybody who's not doing all of these things. It is municipalities that are doing this planning away from centers of economic development. Yes, they know that their own municipalities would depend for the revenue on the economic growth, but yet they plan away. How do we coerce them to do the right thing instead of giving them incentives this time around? I'm saying, for me, that's a critical matter. Because part of the problem is exactly the point that they don't do things in terms of the same IEDP they have adopted themselves. And so how do we deal with that without really trying We had a discussion, it's a pity some of you are not there, some of you are there, with the metros. Cape Town boasts to us that their finances are healthy, granted. They tell us that the only land they have is Atlantis, far from town. Now, only land available belongs to the provincial government. Maybe again the partnership thing comes in. And so, in terms therefore of these issues, infrastructure issues, and the areas where they would invest, Atlantis is the only ideal because it's already far and out. How do they deal with that as Cape Town? But there's an interesting example that we know ourselves. Mushawing is our shining example. Very poor rural, seems to have the capacity to do the right things. And so this rural things, people that talk about, really does not for us, not a big issue really. Now, you're raising, therefore, the issues of support and strength and healthy and sustainable communities, focus on the... But part of the big problem, Khatle will tell you, and most of the people that have been with us in our road shows, as Mr. Sokoni says, the first thing that is said by both national and provincial departments is you encounter resistance. You've got good intentions, you want to assist. You want to assist your municipality, give them support, and this is what we've been raising ourselves, why the support is not coming. people say, no, but municipalities see us as infringing on their terrain. Again, how do we deal with that? Now, of course, I'm not talking the politics. There are also political issues that become a big issue in respect of that. And then, now part of the issue that is critical for us, that is related to that section 39, is how do we deal with national departments and provincial departments that decide, one, not to honor IDP sessions, if you like, IDP reviews, send junior officials, and so decide to parachute projects. But number two, I'm raising these practical problems because they have come to our own attention. MEC is available, commits verbally, not in writing. They don't gazette. Now the commitment was verbal. The poor municipality puts the commitment in the budget. Way down, they've got to adjust down because the money is not coming. How do we deal with that? Issues of houses, clinics, schools, water, sanitation, roads, and so on. How do we deal with that? Of course, there's this big issue that is always raised of bulk infrastructure. Again, the issues of alignment, how do we deal with that? How should we punish people who do not participate at the level of those things? Yes, Mr. Sokol.
Chair, before you pass this one of the grants, there are those municipalities, for instance, who show us, according in terms of their books, that they utilize the grants that they receive every day. But their own grants, I mean, our understanding is that if people have capacity to utilize the grant and there's a need, it will grow. But some of them have shown us that it is either not been increased or instead it has been decreased. So how do you deal with that situation?
Now, you then have a situation where some of these people do not do all of these things and do something else. How do you deal with that? I'm saying the conditions are clear, but the stick is not very clear. We know the stick in terms of withholding and reallocating. That we know. But how do we deal? I mean, there's a big problem in the Northwest, for instance, where some municipalities are not able to pay their own staff and so on and so on. District is taking over that. Yes, the district does not even have the revenue. And so we can talk and talk over about these things. Over to you, sir.
No, you see, whenever the treasury comes to the committee, very interesting stuff comes up. We will be talking about this infrastructure when we talk about the division of revenue bill later on in the month. You know, Honorable Chair, I mean, I was listening to some of the comments actually of all the members who spoke. And the question that I ask is, isn't it the question of we have left our municipalities all along to just do their own thing? How do we come in and influence certain things? I think that is at the heart of this. Now, part of the regulations that we put forward are starting to bring in on the financial side how you solve quite a bit of this thing. Now, at the heart of your question, Honorable Chair, it has got to do how do you deal with non-performance. in the treasury, you get demoted. If you're very unlucky, you get fired. And you follow the right procedures. And I think that's the reason why the treasury prides itself to be performing quite well in its own eyes. You know that in terms of there's an index internationally where transparency in budget documents, transparency in finances is measured, and worldwide South Africa is ranked second as one of the most transparent countries when it comes to its finances. I wonder how it will be ranked if we were looking at on the performance side. And these are the issues that you are raising. Now, there are certain things that a treasury can do, then there are certain things that oversight bodies can do. And I think within legislation, I'm not too sure whether it's even, I think it's in the MFMA where it is clearly stipulated. If you do that wrong, these are the sanctions that need to be in place. Now, who oversees those particular sanctions? You have visited a number of municipalities. You have invited a number of departments there. In many cases, there was issues around non-performance that came up. But did the committee take the next step and say, but HOD, I think it is time that we talk to your minister, you must get fired, or sanctions must take place? I asked the committee, have you taken the next step? I don't know. It will help if you can help us, basically, with that. Let me come to some of the issues that were raised around the metros and the fact that we're putting money, too much money, into the metros. Now, I don't want the committee to move away with that intention. If we didn't put in the differentiated approach, the formula would have allocated the money, in any case, to those particular metros in that way. So it is not as if we are differentiating and we're adding more money to the metros at the expense of the small ones. In fact, this approach starts to favor the smaller ones. Let me demonstrate why I say so. The formula that we use is mainly demographic driven. Backlogs on water, sanitation, and all of that per household. And if you look at the slides that Madijeng showed, a large chunk of these backlogs in urban areas are in urban areas. So if we had to update this formula, for example, a lot of the make money would go to the urban areas, which we don't want to do. Now, by splitting it up, the next step is going to be we want a specific formula only for the cities, so that redistribution takes place within those cities only. Then we'll have a special formula at some point for the rest of the rural ones. And the committee mustn't lose sight. This is the third year, or the second year, where we're going to introduce the minimum allocation for municipalities on MEG. If you can remember, some of the municipalities were getting 200,000 rand for MEG. This is just 2 years ago. Now they get about 4 million rand. We expect that allocation in 2-3 years time will grow to 6-7 million. And it will start to address some of the issues that Memkunu is also raising. So we're trying to deal with the equity issues also by splitting it up. It's easy to say municipalities must go and borrow. Now, we must also look at the intertemporal nature of borrowing. You borrow today, you must put in the infrastructure so that future generations can also repay. That's one aspect of it. If you don't do it right, you may create further problems. Second part, if we look at the world economy today, what are the chances of some of our municipalities going in now, for that matter, to enter the debt market, given the challenges that they are faced with? So there may be a challenge even for those municipalities over the next 3 to 5 years. That doesn't say we shouldn't bring in the DBSA. How do we get them in so that they can play a particular role in there? Now, people will say these metros or the large municipalities have a large revenue base, and they can actually tap into it so that they can provide some of these services. But we must also look at the profile of some of these municipalities. And where a municipality has got a large chunk of the indigent, and it is already cross-subsidizing is that matter that they actually come into play. In economics, I think there's a term that we use there, I think it's the Laffer curve, the relationship between tax rate and tax revenue. If you increase your tax rate, you will generate revenue. But if you start to increase it too much, you get a point where your tax revenue then start to decline. You see? So there is also that issue at play with the municipalities. Because some of the municipalities, for example, increase their property rates into exorbitant. And it's how you manage also your tax system so that you can also attract people, businesses, within your economic base within those particular cities. So we shouldn't just be looking at it too much from one sided of it. But also when we talk about the balance between economic maintenance and all of these things. Now, we will provide you with additional information. Mari Jayang has got some policy framework document on what we are doing. About 80%, and I think the local government budget and expenditure review shows this. About 75 to 80% of economic activity in this country takes place in 26 municipalities. The six metros and your secondary ones. Then you've got your rural ones that have got an economic base and for that matter an economic potential. But if those six metros or those 26 municipalities fail, if they fail, this country can land into a big economic problem. It can find itself in a big economic problem. So we should just be careful how we then even think about how we then talk about the economic relations that actually happens in the city. Now, the local government budget and expenditure review also shows that these municipalities don't put in a lot of money for maintenance, for example. And we only picked it up, starting to pick it up now that the information is improving. And with the regulations that will be discussed later on, the information will even improve even further. But the risk of not getting the balance right even with that maintenance and rolling out particular infrastructure, again, you're going to have a problem if you don't deal with it. Now, Michael, we don't say leave the rural places on their own. We don't say it. And we want to actually find ways of channeling not only resources there, but also the kinds of right capacities so that those rural municipalities can in itself become viable. If you read the Daily Dispatch in London, they call it the Daily Disgrace because it just shows everything that goes wrong in the province. And you will see simple things that don't need money just don't get done in those municipalities if you think about it. If you look at the spillage into I think somebody was bitten by a shark. There was a shark attack because of a waste spillage in there. And it has got to do with somebody that must just press a button or two. You see? So it has got to do, some of the things doesn't talk to money, but some of the things talk to whether the people are there to be able to actually do the jobs that they actually are paid for to be done. Now, I don't want to digress too much, Honorable Chair. We will still talk about this when we talk about the division of revenue. But we will talk about the bus subsidies. And you are right. Oh, no, thank you. I'm protected. I don't know whether you want to add anything.
Yeah. The issue of additional money on absorption capacity, I think, is settled because you're not adding any new money. You know, we are just trying to say how can we repackage this money so that we are able to leverage more out of it and to unlock some of the monies that we are talking about. I think that the issue of the skills and competences, and that is a major problem with the current system, that we have lost proper focus in actually creating that capacity. Because why? The manner in which we manage the need now, we are treating all municipalities the same, looking at signing off on the technical reports, even for municipalities that actually have more capacity than the people that are supposed to assess those reports. So what we are saying is, why would you want to put that kind of capacity to begin to tick, tick, tick projects for the municipalities that actually have capacity, and yet maybe you are missing a bigger picture of the things that you need to look at? And rather lose that capacity, therefore, to begin to look at what can we do to to actually begin to address the issues on these smaller capacity municipalities. I think we have not focused enough, even in terms of looking at the differentiated way even the lower capacity municipalities, because you are not going to adopt the same approach, because there are some municipalities that perhaps need somebody to come and implement, because by nature they will never be able to attract anybody. And maybe they don't need top engineers, because you need to implement and then just put people to do maintenance. So you need a different approach. And there hasn't been proper focus. And we are hoping that now that we are beginning to zoom in into these municipalities and acknowledging the differences in terms of their context, then we can begin to focus properly to say the kind of levers that we can use to begin to unlock the capacity, what are they? They will be different in these cities, clearly. So I think the issue of planning, obviously, because we're not adding any new money, there is still a process, and we have been working very much with the Metro since July, actually. We have been running this process, and them coming to indicate to us their plans and highlight. So the process has been ongoing, the system, in terms of their plan. And this has actually helped them a lot also to begin to look at things in a particular way, seeing that the environment will enable them to begin to take some bit of control in terms of the decisions. Because I promise you, some of the projects, even the housing, the decisions taken outside of municipality, and then they get far away. So as long as they don't have control of a lot of matters in the built environment, there is no way we can actually take them fully accountable for that, for the outcomes. And we are hoping that this is actually a step that will enable us actually to pull all the elements of the built environment, so that even at the national level, the kind of rules and conditions begin to enable the alignment and integration at the municipal level, which is still a problem at the moment.
Let me check something. You see, are we saying, for instance, that in the maybe next year, we shall see now accreditation of municipalities, if you like, rolled out, because that's one of the big issues, just in respect of housing, for instance. Now, part of the big issue, I think, is discussion amongst yourselves, for instance. Now, to what extent is the National Treasury in discussion with the other sectors? Now, I'm raising here this because we know that Buffalo City is going to be a metro soon, and Mangaung, and yet they still are at this particular level. And so, engaging with the demarcation board, engaging with everybody, just... You see, some people would want to be metros, if you like, for the sake of it. And yet they continue to underperform. In other words, you compensate underperformance. I'm just saying, how do we then engage with all of these processes of unlocking accreditation for municipalities, of ensuring that the demarcation board does not just give them this particular status for the sake of it, and so on and so on, so that as we roll out of all of these programs, you don't want to, again, it rolls back one step forward and two steps backward. You don't want that kind of an unintended consequence, if you like. But are we also engaging with all of those people? Well, part of the problem is that here you would have, people would always agree that we have capacity. Have we also done an in-depth study and audit just to establish that exactly the required capacity is available? If you're saying Nelson Mandela, say Buffalo City, for instance, is becoming a metro soon. I'm saying, just raising these things so that, and you, as you talk about all of these things, you see, for us, we always fail to understand why people underperform. When budgets were multi-year, because we also expected plans to be multi-year, and so why the March spike? Clearly, those funny things worried us. And now have we resolved all of these things of engagement. But there's this big thing that you also not, Mr. Kenneth raises. It's a matter that we've been raising ourselves in our discussions in provinces. But by the way, the discussions we've had for all the eight provinces, were not necessary if national and provincial departments were doing what they had to do, just in terms of the law. The law is clear. But while these departments were also doing these things, municipalities were also resisting. I know of people that were withdrawn by national departments because municipalities were resisting. Machabing, for instance, 4 technical people were to be withdrawn by the DBSA. And in many other municipalities, because the conditions in the municipalities were not conducive for people to do what they had to do, both from national and provincial departments. Have we dealt with those matters?
Honorable Chair, let me talk about some of the skills issue, but let me just come back to 2 points. One is on this capacity thing. And I hope I'm going to use the right choice of words. And I make this point. China, as a metro, has doubled in size the past 10 years. If you go Pretoria East and you look at the developments in the entire eastern part of Pretoria, you are shocked. But also when you're from Joburg, if you look at Joburg today and Joburg of 10 years ago, there's two different Joburgs. We can mention it. Come to Cape Town. There's one corridor, yeah. As you go on the N1, as you go out of Cape Town. Cape Town has doubled in size. Why have those municipalities doubled then? On the people who can afford to pay, on all of that. Us. Where there was failure in many cases is more on the indigent side. Why may there have been failure on the indigent side? It's because some of the functions that needs to be with the municipalities are not with the municipality. You talk about this accreditation. Now, this thing has been raised a number of times. DPLG is reviewing it with its white paper process. We hope it will eventually get to finality. And I think the approach here is really to say, when we see the next doubling of our cities, it ought to take into account the indigent and the indigent being better off. So clearly there is capacity in these municipalities to do it. It is just that we must be able to influence it so that it can also take into account the poor and how we bring the poor actually on stream. Also, when you were talking about migration, and you know, and Honorable Chair, you also spoke about it in Nizna and all of that. And Honorable Members, I'm going to also briefly touch on it. We have to accept it. It's an international trend. People are migrating to big cities. We have to accept it. I think it happens. It may be for a number of reasons, but in general terms, people are migrating into big cities. The question is, are those cities then ready to welcome those people so that we don't have first informal settlements and then want to deal with it? But so that we plan our cities in such a way that when people come, we already know where they can be located and be placed. When people come, comes economic opportunity as well, because then it means there may be a need for greater factories and all of those kinds of things. Now our cities, I don't think, we have been doing well as cities, but I don't think to the extent where we think they should have done. And this is an opportunity for us to say, how do we then influence the processes there. I propose, Honorable Chair, I mean, TV will touch on one thing, and then we're going to take up this thing when we spoke about the division of revenue, because you're talking about the capacity assessment, the number of issues that you've raised. What we will do when we present it again is to start to answer some of those questions again. TV?
Thanks, Honorable Members. I think it's important that from a financial management side, we've been focusing a lot on improving capacity over the last few years. The regulatory side is may be in place now, but the compliance with the regulations is where the challenge lies still. And the compliance is basically at a municipal level, with accountability for appointments and others within the municipality, residing at the municipality and the MN largely. So I think that's the one issue. The second dynamic we have is we've been trying to promote a number of formal and other supporting capacity building initiatives. Here through the internship program you know about, there's 503 interns now and we're trying to grow it to 1,500. There's a large proportion of them being appointed in municipalities already, so it shows a relative success. The updating of training providers. Before it was just a few training providers around the country and it was very costly. Now we have 31 training providers. So the quality of the broader financial management related aspects for municipalities has been taken care of. It's now implementing that and we're in that phase. I think what we will be doing as well, and we've started, is actually doing a capacity survey of the budget and treasury office in municipalities. We call it that, given where the Act is situated, the Budget and Treasury Office. Out of that, 28 has been completed in the Eastern Cape. Feedback is given back to the municipal managers and CFOs around their own competence and areas of gaps that we see. So in the process of getting to understanding where the capacity concerns lie, we've rolled out this program now with all our provincial treasury support. By the 31st of March, they should have their first reports in, outlining where the gaps are from a financial management perspective. Now, there is another forum that's already been developed, and the committees of that forum have set a quite ambitious agenda. They make up of the separate line sector functional departments at national level. They've met on the capacity issues. They are wanting to replicate what we have in the MFMA for the different type of services that we spoke about, the water, the sanitation, the hard technical services. They've also looking at possible replication of the regulations in the way that we've done it and trying to work on a similar model. So there is something that has started. This is chaired by DPLG, and they want to roll some of this program out within a very short space of time. So that's just a brief update of where we know where capacity surveys, capacity, understanding of where the weaknesses lie is actually taking place. So through that, hopefully, we can put then the corrective measures in place. But largely, just to give you a sense of where the progress is. And while we have the floor, Chair, you will note that we've done our bit for capacity, so there should be no excuse by municipal officials to say they don't know. There's a calendar on the MFMA implementation that's been distributed to all municipalities. Committee members have got a copy as well. Thanks. Chair with the committee. Thanks.
Okay. Look, we will have more discussions on this matter. Interesting stuff. Mengalini says it's a new packaging. We will have to monitor this packaging. And of course, we take the challenge of the next step ourselves. We are a bit militant in that regard. But we also needed to start somewhere. So that when we go to the next stage, at least people have been prepared. We needed to start somewhere, and unfortunately, if you look at all the municipalities, province by province, we had not touched all the municipalities per province. So we still have to go back to those at that particular stage where we started, so that when we've done that, we then can move to the next stage. For instance, in the Eastern Cape, we dealt with only about 3 municipalities. And then in some provinces, there were much more, about 10, 12, 15. And so we really are ready for, let me not say ready for the next stage, but we still have to complete the whole lot, but still have to go back to the same, just to see whether there's been some improvements where we started with the little basics that we were raising. As I'm saying, this new discussion that relates to enhancing development outcomes of municipal capital expenditure is exciting, but surely I think this interaction must also not be with and municipalities alone. There are provincial departments that are problematic there, that do not play their own roles, just in respect of ensuring that they honor the IDP engagement. It's a part of what we have not yet discussed. It's something that we are raising sharply ourselves now in the context of the IDP, but also even in the budget. There are two things that we are raising. In the IDP, we have raised it for DPLG. What are you looking at when you evaluate an IDP document? Are you looking at the process or the content? If it is the process, exactly what are you looking for? If it is the content, exactly what are you looking for as you evaluate? Because we hear people are ranking IDPs 1, 2, 3, and 4. Now, part of the big problem, John, you know that municipalities have about 20,000-30,000 plus in terms of their, each ward is so big that you've got about 20,000-30,000 households or people. Now, an IDP review is done in this kind of a hall. So, now would you then say the 100 people in a hall represent kind of a survey, like, if you like, not the real issues? And so what would be the basis of saying that this IDP is credible? And the issues of credibilities of budgets. Why is it that there's over or underspending where budgets credible? And so clearly there's a whole range of issues that we still have to talk to. But let's allow Mr. Harding to take us through now the other stuff. No, we'll be coming back to that discussion of infrastructure. Huh? What is that matter of life and death?
Whatever we do, the areas that are traditionally that should not be forgotten, because we can get overexcited about migration to towns, but then we must not forget the experience of Europe in the 17th century, where when people flocked to towns, but then there was a question of diseases, the Black Death, before the plague. And then we know that there's the issue of cholera, which is coming down, and it's going to affect even our cities right now. Thank you.
You know, cholera, Mama Nangchun. Some of you do not do the basics when you go wherever you go. Thanks for that. Unjani?
Chairperson, thank you. Thanks, Chair. Honourable members, thank you for the opportunity. Conrad is going to do the actual presentation, but I just want to make a few introductory remarks. I think in the local government budget and expenditure review, Chair, we have listed a host of challenges facing local government. Today we are offering you two solutions. The one is the one that Marajeng has spoken about, essentially meaning that the way we allocate resources is important going forward and the issues that's involved. The second one that we're offering today is the regulations. And Chair, our experience in the National Treasury is over the last number of years is you start fixing service delivery challenges essentially if you fix the budget. So what we are producing today to yourself is a package of the budget and reporting regulations. Chair, it took a number of years to get to this point. It is hard work that the Treasury has put in the process. What we would like to try and do in the presentation is to give you a sense of the rationale that we've used to determine this package of regulation. And hopefully when we're done, Chair, that you have a good sense of what is it all about and how does the Treasury's thought process work. Chair, With that introduction, I'm going to ask Kenneth to take you through the presentation, and then obviously we'll, Conrad. So Conrad, the floor is yours.
Yeah, so we are recording this. Thank you, Chair. I've first got some introductory just observations. I would like to apologize for the title that I gave to the committee. It's the Select Committee, and on your presentation I say the Standing Committee. I apologize. Yes, it comes from, you know, my background. I do apologize for that. The first slide sets out what essentially is the problem statement, and it's something that Kenneth made reference to, and that essentially we have 283 different municipal budgets. And although we've been trying to bring some uniformity into the way budget information is presented at a local government level through Circular 28, this has not achieved the desired outcome yet. And the consequence of having the 283 different budgets is that we're not able to aggregate information very easily, and this means that the analysis of what is happening at a local government level from a provincial but also from a national perspective is very difficult, because the aggregation takes time, and so by the time we've consolidated all the information, it's almost 2 years on, and the picture has changed slightly. The other thing is that when you look at many municipal budgets, you actually take the budget document and you go through that document. It consists of tables with numbers in it. Now, if you come from a national parliament perspective, or if you come from a provincial legislature perspective, and you look at the budget documentation, it's, one could say, it's half numbers and half words, and the words explain the numbers. And in essence, we're missing that in many local government budgets. We're only getting half the picture if the numbers are correct, and we're missing the explanations to those numbers. And so it's very difficult to interpret what municipalities are seeking to achieve through their budgets. It's almost as if the budgets are it's not an accountability document, it's an accounting tool, whereas a budget is intended to be an accountability document. Okay. The third issue, and this is one that we've touched on in the discussion already, is the relationship between the IDP document, the budget, and then following it through in-year reports and ultimately into the annual financial statements and the annual report. That linkage is very weak at the moment. And so one's not able to say, okay, this is the objective within the IDP. How is it funded in the budget? In many municipalities, that link is not made very strongly. The other problem in that linkage is that things are committed in the IDP, but they're not planned for in the budget. And then even when you come to the implementation of the budget, there's the introduction of frequent adjustments budgets, because the original planning underpinning the budget was weak. And so the municipality, there's a phrase that says they plan to implement what they didn't plan. And that is a serious problem at the local government level. Now, this compromises monitoring and oversight, because you're not able to trace things from the IDP through to the annual report. And it also compromises national and provincial's ability to formulate coherent policies. And to compensate for this weakness in the budget documentation and the linkages through to other reporting instruments, we find that national departments and provincial departments are sending out some supplementary questionnaires to municipalities. And we did a study of, we formed a working group around this problem, and we identified the fact that national departments are requesting 15,400 pieces of financial information from municipalities per year. And then you ask, well, how does that impact upon their workflow, their capacity to do other things than just fill in questionnaires from national government? And what we want to, one of the aims of this reform is to try and eliminate these supplementary questionnaires so that a municipality submits a single set of information. That single set of information is accredited, certified by the municipal manager. We check it as National Treasury. And then if any other department wants information on the budget or on financial matters relating to the budget, such as in-year monitoring, in-year reports, that they obtain it from a single source, and that will be the National Treasury, that they don't impose on the limited capacity at the local municipality, local level, by requesting additional information continuously. We're also looking at the issue of the fact that there's a lack of an overarching picture on infrastructure spending. We have good information on the MIG, but what is happening with the other 70% of the infrastructure budget at the municipal level? Or if you're in the metro, we have good information on 10% of their budget, and the other 90%, we don't have an overarching picture of that. Or it takes time to consolidate that overarching picture. And so we want to, let's say, facilitate better information around the management of infrastructure. And then probably most critically is that because of the lack of quality in budget documents, because they're not explained in words, municipal councils are probably making the wrong decisions because they're not given the right information to make the right decisions. And this is really a very serious concern that we would like to address through these regulations. Okay. Obviously, there are certain guiding principles that we need to adhere to when we're compiling a set of regulations of this nature. I'm not going to go through this in any detail. They're the usual good things that we want to achieve. Simply to highlight that we want to strengthen the role of the medium-term revenue and expenditure framework so as to improve the quality of planning and budget implementation in municipalities. And we want to promote integrated planning of infrastructure maintenance and operational expenditure. We want to see municipalities beginning to manage their infrastructure as a package, not that they deal with MIG money on this side, DBSA-funded projects on that side, donor-funded projects over here, and then, oh yes, we do have a little bit of money that we allocate to infrastructure as a municipality. That is a fragmented approach that results in the perpetuation of the spatial planning plans of our rural areas and cities as they occur at the present moment. We want to see all that managed as an integrated package, that a DBSA project needs to feed in to the overall package of infrastructure development. And then that needs to be linked to maintenance, and then also to operating expenditure. You can't build a fancy sewerage works and not take into account the operating implications of running those sewerage works. Are you going to have the revenue to fund the operational expenditure to make sure that you've got the personnel, the maintenance, the chemicals that you require to run that? Now, all of that needs to be thought about within a holistic package. We then also, as a national treasury, but also as national government, we want to look at the intercomparability of municipalities, that we can say that one's in crisis, that one is doing well, and if the information will assist us in that. And then we want to facilitate the process of producing a consolidated set of government financial statistics fatalities. I'm on the fourth slide. That's a picture titled The Accountability Cycle. If you look at that picture, you will see that it starts with the IDP, goes to the budget, the service delivery and budget implementation plan, your in-year reports, which are your monthly financial monthly budget statements, your quarterly mails reports to council, and then your mid-year reports, and then you have your annual report and your annual financial statements. Okay. Now, what we want to look for is what I call a golden thread that runs all the way from the IDP through to your annual report, that you can say, yes, that plan, that project was planned in the IDP, it was funded in the budget, its implementation was planned in the SDIP, we monitored its implementation through the monthly budget statements, and then we reported on its accomplishment in the annual report. Now that is the line that we want to begin to draw between these documents. On the other hand, we may want to say, look, we planned something in the IDP, and due to some breakdown in the management of this project, it wasn't achieved. And that is also important for transparency purposes, that we evaluate both our successes and our failures were at a municipal level so that we can learn and improve things over time. Now, these particular regulations talk about the information that is contained in the budget document and in the in-year monitoring documents. But it links to the IDP and then through to the annual report. You'll see there's an arrow that sort of points down into the ground. That is pointing to the standard chart of accounts. And that's the next project in this implementation process in order to bring a measure of uniformity at a accounting level within the local government sphere so that when we count a pen, it's classified as a pen in all municipalities. If we're talking about maintenance of a road, we use the same classification. It will enhance the quality of the information. I'm not going to spend much time on the legal framework, simply to note that it's located, the production of these regulations are located within section 215 and 216 of the Constitution, and are related to the obligation that is placed on national government to prescribe budget formats. That is then spelt out further in the MFMA, and the MFMA requires specifically, I'm on page 8, that an annual budget must be in a schedule in the prescribed format. That is very important because the legislature has indicated that it requires local government to report in the prescribed format. Okay. Now, that has had implications for the way that the regulations have been drafted, and I will highlight those as we go through the way the legislation is drafted. Okay, some background to the reform on page 10. The process of changing the way budgeting is done at a local government comes a long way. Work began in 2000 and continued through to 2005, and December 2005 was an important, let's call it an important watershed, whereas prior to that date where there had been testing and piloting and exploring what is the best approach to use at local government level, a decision was taken in December 2005 to go in a particular direction. And that was emphasized, or that was captured through the issuing of Circular 28. Now, Circular 28 essentially identifies the key elements of information that is required in a municipal budget. It is supported by a range of tables that National Treasury produced, and municipalities were encouraged to apply Circular 28 format in their 2006 and 7, 8, 7 and 8 and 8 and 9 budgets. Now, there are two weaknesses with Circular 28. Firstly, it does not comply with Section 17 of the MSMA, in that it's not a schedule in the prescribed format. Given the nature that of a circular, it's a guideline to municipalities. Okay? The second weakness of Circular 28 is that because it's only a guideline, unless the municipal council adopts that circular as council policy, the council can choose not to comply with Circular 28. And this is resulted in the perpetuation of the problem that we identified, which is instead of having 283 municipal budgets in the same format, which is the objective of the Circular 28 reform, we still have 283 budgets in different formats. Okay, so that is, Circular 28 moved us along the path, but it didn't take us far enough. And so the next logical step is to fulfill the legislature's requirement that the budgets be in the prescribed format. Okay. That brings us to Circular 42, and this relates to Section 15, 17, and 18 of the MFMA, which is the requirement that a municipal budget must be fully funded or properly funded. And it sets out a funding compliance test. Now, unlike national and provincial budgets, if you look at the bottom line of the budget and it shows a deficit, then you know that the budget is not fully funded. Now, because municipalities are working on an accrual basis, but also because they raise their own revenue, using the bottom line as a test is not sufficient. Yes, it's the first indicator of whether the budget is fully funded. But even if they say, no, we're going to generate a surplus, one needs to test whether the numbers that they use in order to report a surplus are credible numbers. In other words, the way they project revenue, the way they project expenditure, are those credible projections? And so the funding compliance test explores a range of variables that enable us to make a statement as to whether this budget is adequately funded or not. Right. The latest developments around the regulations, they were drafted and consulted over 2007-2008. You can see the different consultation processes that took place and the different role players that have been involved in the consultations. It's been extensive. We've also tested the formats that underpin the budgets with the data from four municipalities, choosing a metro, a large city, and then a smaller town and a district municipality. We've also engaged Etiquini Metro and asked them to pilot the budget format in their 2008-09 budgets. And that has been quite an exciting exercise in that the budget, in other words, this has moved beyond theory in its formulation. We've actually tested it live with one of the more complicated municipalities in the country. And the encouraging thing is that they were able to comply with probably over 90% of the formats. There were some technical difficulties that they needed to sort out on their system side in order to be able to generate the information. But it wasn't, let's say, what we're asking for wasn't an insurmountable task. We released the formats themselves, the budget formats themselves, on Treasury's website on the 28th of June and informed municipalities that that is the direction that we're going to be going and asked them to start giving us feedback on the formats. Whilst that was ongoing, we were busy consulting on the regulations and also getting the regulations through a fairly, well, actually it was a very rigorous legal check to make sure that they within the confines of the MFMA and also comply are constitutionally sound. And that draft was then presented to the minister and he approved that on the 5th of December. We've got the concurrence of the Minister of Provincial and Local Government for these regulations. You'll see that right at the front, that these are published with the concurrence of the DPLG Minister as required by the MFMA. And then we've published them for public comment on the 23rd of June. We're currently in the, let's call it the phase of public comment and parliamentary consultation as required by the MFMA. And we're looking at ending off both of those processes round about the 5th of March. And the reason for drawing a line there is that we want to finalize them for implementation in the new financial year of local government. Okay. The next slide is actually, it's a bit complicated, but if you go right to the end of your presentation that you have in front of you, it's the last slide, slide 36, just gives you the scope of consultations that we've engaged in so far. When we say Eastern Cape, on the 14th of January, for instance, we had, well, we don't know if we had every single municipality there, but we had 160 people attend a consultation session where we presented the presentation, the regulations to them, went through them in quite a lot of detail and asked for feedback. And we've been to every province so far except the Northern Cape, which you see is Sam's job on Wednesday this week. Or Thursday. And then we've still got, well, we're currently with the select committee here, and then we've got a number of other processes that are ongoing with DPLG and the provincial treasuries, and also with the 27 municipalities that need to implement, well, that we are asking to implement the budget formats as from the upcoming financial year. Yes, it's an extensive program, but you have your schedule, we have our schedule. the scope of regulations, very briefly, consists of six chapters. Obviously, the first chapter, if you is the normal things that deal with the interpretation, objects, and application of these regulations. The second chapter applies to municipalities, and that deals with the budgets, the formats of the budgets, the format of adjustments budgets, and the formats of in-year reports, and then processes related to those reports. You then have the budgets and budget-related matters of municipal entities, and again, their budgets, their adjustments budgets, and their in-year reports. Chapter 4 of the regulations deals with non-compliance with time provisions. If you don't submit your budget documents in time to council, what are the processes that need to be followed in order to rectify that non-compliance? Chapter 5, in the MFMA, there's a requirement for a framework for unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure. These regulations now fill that gap that existed, and we now provide such a framework. And the idea is to give a very clear definition of unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure so that municipalities are left in no doubt where to draw the line. And then you have a number of provisions dealing with unauthorized expenditure. Now, an integral component of the regulations are the schedules and the attachments to the schedules. Schedule IA, D, then by the municipality. Schedule G is a little different. That speaks to Chapter 4, which is the non-compliance with time provisions, and it provides basically a form that municipalities will need to complete in order to apply for extensions to time provisions related to the documentation. We were talking about the fact that the MSMA requires the budget to be in the prescribed format. The annual budget tables are the prescribed format, and so you have 10 prescribed tables in which the budget must appear. And you see the list of tables there. We'll go through them in slightly more detail just now. I'm just providing you with a strategic overview of the contents of these regulations. Those tables are to be found from page 1, I think it's 123 onward, no? 112 onwards. So if you go into your regulations, page 112, you see the tables that are required. Now, there are quite a lot of tables. Don't be intimidated by the quantity. There's some repetition. In other words, where a municipality has municipal entities, they need to produce two sets of tables, one for the municipality itself, and then a consolidated set of tables for the municipality plus the entities that it has, so that you get an overarching picture of the operations that the municipality is responsible for. So the tables, there is some repetition in the tables. And you'll also see that if you compare the list of tables on page 16 of the presentation to those on page 17, that we're drawing this golden thread from the budget to the adjustments budget to the in-year reports, that there are many similarities between the tables, but they serve slightly different purposes, in that the budget says what they're going to do, the adjustments budget then modifies that, and then the in-year reports report on what they should be doing, all in the same or similar format. Okay. Right. Now what I want to do is to go to the first half of the regulation, starting on about page 10, if we start on page 12. And I simply want to draw the committee's attention to some key regulations and what their purpose is within the overall framework. And the first thing is on if you look on slide 20, it's the picture that says structure of regulations. Do you see that? It's got pretty pictures, blue, orange, green, and purple. Is that orange? Okay. And it says, at the top it says document, and then regulation, format, and attachment. Okay. black on black isn't very visible. And if you use dark green, it wouldn't be too visible either. I said visibility. we use yellow at the bottom, so the foundation has got something to do with it. Okay, moving on. I just want to take you through one so that you get an idea of how the document is structured. If you go to the municipal budget and you turn to page 15 of the regulation. Okay. Do you have the document? Can you? Oh. Okay. Then you see Regulation 9. It says the annual budget and supporting documents of the municipality must be in the format specified in Schedule A. And then it says, and include all the required tables and so on. Okay. So this is the regulation that says that the budget must be in a prescribed format. The prescribed format is then provided on page 53 of the Government Gazette. So if you turn to page 53, you get to a schedule that says annual budgets and supporting documentation of municipalities. And that essentially sets out a format for the budget document. Okay. And the main portion of that budget document is reflected in part one of the document. So you go down, it says table of contents, part one, it says annual budget. And you'll see that the fourth item under annual budget says annual budget tables. Now those annual budget tables are provided in the first attachment to Schedule A, which is on page 108. The annual budget tables. Okay. Are on page 108. Now, it was simply, you know, why do we structure the documents in this way? It's a practical issue. That you want to understand the flow of the regulations and not intersperse it with the schedule for the budget document. We want all the schedules in one place and all the tables in one place so that it's easily understood. And you'll see that the municipal adjustments budgets are structured in the same way. Regulation 21 prescribes the schedule. The schedule B is for the municipal adjustments budget is on page 68, and then the tables that support the adjustments budget are on page 134. And so it's a fairly, we use a consistent methodology with regards to each of the different documents. Okay.
Proceed. Now there's a R here. What happens if there is no cash backed reserves or accumulated surplus? If a municipality does not have that, what happens? What document would you ask for? Cashback reserves, accumulated surplus, reconciliation. If I don't have those, what would you do? What document would you ask for there?
That information is also derived from your previous financial statements. Where you close off the municipality's books of accounts in the previous year, you will see that arising through the preparation of the financial statements. If there is no surplus, then that amount in that column will be zero. If there's a deficit, we should be able to see the difference between the balancing items.
You're referring particularly to Table A1 budget summary, and you must that is a budget summary, so it's just highlighting certain key features of the budget. There's a lot more detail dealing with cashback reserves on one of the tables further back. In fact, it's Table A8, and we ask for further detail, so they need to show us what is their financial position with regards to those particular items. The summary table just provides a very high-level summary so that you can look at a single page and get an understanding of where the money is coming from and where it's being allocated for that particular municipality. The detail is then provided in the other 9 tables, and then additional to that, and that's something we'll come to, National Treasury is also requiring municipalities to provide even more detailed information to what is required in these 9 tables, 10 tables. Okay.
there provision for diverted funds? When the IDP is made, then a budget is made for a particular program. But then you find that in the report, it says that that project was done, but you go to the actual site, nothing has been done. And then you get from here, says that that money was used for another project. Is there provision for that here?
Chairperson, what we've done is, and it's not part of the 10 slides, but part of a supporting table is, if you told the public last year this is what you're going to deliver, and you fail to deliver, we are going to introduce as part of a supporting document, as table to say, because the easy thing is to sweep it under the carpet. So there is a table that we insist that all municipalities have to produce to say exactly what happened to those projects. Was it a choice, an ad hoc choice, was it a planned choice, or whatever. So that information will also now be available to not only to the public, but to yourself as well, to track these projects. Because it's easy to do the smart and sexy things, but the ones that's really fundamental to service delivery, it's easy to derail them. And there is a specific schedule that we've designed to capture that information.
Okay. You know, we'd all love to answer these questions, because when you know you've done the work, then you can give the answer. So yes, it's very satisfying to be able to meet the requirements of the committee. Okay. Just highlighting some key regulations that we'd like to draw to the committee's attention. Under Regulation 4, we're back on page 12. Okay. In the MFMA, there's a requirement that the mayor of the municipality establish a budget steering committee. Now, the MFMA doesn't indicate who should sit on that steering committee, and quite often one finds that it's not the appropriate people. And so through this regulation, we are providing a list of people within the municipality that should constitute that steering committee. Within Regulation 8 is talking about the requirement for a municipality to develop a funding and reserves policy. And the idea here is that when a municipality compiles its budget, it should be using a methodology that is sound. In other words, when they project their revenues, how are they doing that? And what we want to see is a municipality place in the public domain how they make their calculations in order to arrive at their numbers. In other words, what assumptions do they make about future growth in revenue? What assumptions do they make about future growth in salaries? And this is all part of making the budget process more transparent, making it more accountable, in that officials can't just put any number into the budget. They need to do it in accordance with a sound methodology that is stated publicly, and that anybody in the municipality can reproduce in order to check the numbers of the municipality. Okay? Related to that is then Regulation 9, which is on page 15, and 10, which is the funding of a budget. Okay? So you've got the schedule, Regulation 9 is the format of the budget, and then Regulation deals with the funding. And if you look at Regulation 10.2, it deals specifically with one of the issues that was raised this morning, where a department or the MEC goes to an IDP meeting and makes a verbal commitment for particular funds, and those funds don't materialize, even though the municipality has put that commitment into their budget. And so what this regulation 10.2 is stipulating is, when may a municipality municipality include funding from other spheres of government in their budgets. And it's identifying the source documents that they need to be able to quote when they include those funding. So, for instance, in the case of a verbal commitment, that is not sufficient evidence to then include that funding in the document, in their budget. So they need to have fairly formal, well, actually very formal documentation supporting the transfer of funds to the municipality. Regulation 13 is important because it deals with Section 19 of the MFMA, which says that all spending on capital projects must be in terms of the approved budget. And it also requires...
No, you see, there's another small problem here on 10.2. And that problem is something we have come across. It's gazetted in the Division of Revenue Act, but then it's revised down. That's another matter. I think it's a challenge that we need to find a way of dealing with. It is gazetted appropriately, maybe as 10 million, but then the transferring department allocates less. But proceed.
Chair, let me answer that one. In the monitoring system that we're busy setting up, there's a comparison between the approved payment schedule that gives effect to that allocation and what actually transpired. And the moment we start having those two numbers, it's easy to spot who is the guilty party and then activate an action. And hopefully that's the way we will solve that problem going forward.
And then who chairs the steering committee? I mean, it's just these are the people that sit in it, but it's not stated to chairs. Is it the mayor? Is it the MM? Is it the member of the financial committee, maker?
It's the mayor. Ideally, should chair it, or otherwise, as delegated to one of the mayor.
Why don't you say, why don't it become clear instead of being ideally? Let's just be clear there. You see what it said there is that these people are going to assist, must establish a budget to assist the mayor in discharging, etc., etc., but just firm up. Because you also don't want a political wrangle that would finally ensure that this thing does not happen. Because some people, maybe the MM, and the, I mean, I'm not sure, but just let's think about it.
Chief.
So good.
Chief. Sorry. What the lawyers has been very firm on us is something is in the act, and it's very explicit, when there was no need to repeat it, but I support your suggestion, so we'll consider that.
Does Chair 4.1, does not 4.1 suffice for terms that the mayor of the municipality must establish the budget steering committee? And if it is the mayor then that is established, it means that the mayor is chairing and the people who sit in the in that steering committee that have listed down there. It does not cover perhaps what you're raising.
But I'm just saying there's this sometimes you have symbolical angles in some cases. And so council does not sit, etc., etc. The mayor is also not doing his work. What do we do? It means work is at a standstill there. That's the bottom line. So just to safeguard, because you do want the administration managers to manage, etc., etc., work to go on, while you have some political problems that might affect service delivery. Think about it. I'm not saying it, let's do it that way, but I'm just saying think about it. Proceed, Mr. Okay.
Just one small thing. When the transfer of funds is done, could there be somewhere space to say transferred with interest? If it has been delayed in a certain level, why should it be the original form only without the interest? What has happened to the interest of that amount? Thank you.
You see, coming back to this thing we're talking about, we were taking out in the MFMA, for instance, councillor involvement. And so you don't want at some stage inadvertently again to kind of be seen to be reversing that in principle. I'm just raising that, but let's proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Regulation 13 relates to Section 19.3 of the MFMA, and it's very important, this particular regulation. It says a municipal council may, in terms of subsection 1B, approve capital projects below a prescribed value, either individually or part of a consolidated capital program. Okay, so there's a requirement that there is a prescribed value below which capital projects may be approved either individually or as part of a program. In other words, any capital project above that prescribed value must be approved individually. So it's setting a threshold between projects that may be approved individually or part of the program and projects that must be approved individually. And so in Regulation 13.2, we identify that threshold for the different size of municipalities. And you'll see that we've divided municipalities up into three categories according to their size of budget, size of revenue budget, and for the smaller municipalities, we've allowed for a smaller size capital project. In other words, the threshold is lower. And then for the very large municipalities, over 500 million, the capital threshold is set at projects larger than 50 million rand. In other words, we're talking about fairly major capital projects here, but given the nature of the operations of such a municipality, even a 50 million rand project isn't a very large project. You think of building a new dual lane highway, you know, that uses up 50 million rand very quickly. And so we've pegged it at 50 million rand. Those amounts are, we're in a phase of public consultation and we're getting feedback about the appropriateness of those amounts from the municipalities and your comments, once you've had time to consider them, will be welcome. The next regulations that are of particular importance relate to the adjustments budget, and that is Regulation 23. And here we're looking at the MFMA Section 28 requires a framework that provides for the time frames of when municipalities may table adjustments budgets. And so it gives National Treasury, in consultation with other role players, the capacity to regulate when municipalities may table adjustments budgets. Now, this has been a particular problem in the local government environment, where municipalities don't take their budget documents seriously. They adjust it whenever they see the need. And so you can have, in good cases, one's dealing with four adjustments budgets a year. In, let's say, less good cases, one can deal with up to 10, 12 adjustments budgets a year. And some of the reasons for introducing adjustments budgets aren't in order to improve service delivery. Particularly adjustments budgets that are introduced in the last month of the financial year. That involves simply massaging the budget numbers so that they look like the expenditure numbers, so that the performances look good and the municipal manager can get their bonus, so that there's no underspending or overspending because they've aligned the two numbers to look the same. Now, this particular regulation allows us to eliminate those bad practices. And so what we've done is we've identified certain kinds of adjust, or certain kinds of incidents that can give rise to an adjustments budget. For instance, needing to respond to poor implementation within a particular project and shift the funds to one that is implementing well. That happens at a national level when you have an adjustments budget around about November. So that's not, you know, that's a practice that is part of in-year management. And what we provide for is that, like at the national level, there is only one adjustments budget to deal with those kinds of planning-related adjustments. Okay, and you can look at the detail. It's Regulation 22 B, D, E, and F. Then we have a second set of adjustments budgets that deal with unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure. Now, those need to be introduced as soon after the unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure has taken place so that the expenditure can be regularized through an adjustments budget. And that is dealt with under Regulation 23.3 of the regulations. And then we also place restrictions on some kinds of adjustments budgets that may be introduced, particularly the unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure that needs to comply with the definition of unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure. And we also require that any adjustments budget must be approved within a certain time period, and if it relates to the authorization of unauthorized expenditure, it must be approved before the end of the financial year. Okay, so those are fairly technical but very important initiatives. Probably the greatest impact that this will have on local government budgeting is it will force municipalities to plan better, because they will no longer have the flexibility that they currently have to change their budgets whenever they see fit or whenever their plans don't work out. They will need to apply their minds to the development of their budgets and their plans related to their budgets, because they won't simply be able to change the month after the budget has been approved by council. Okay. That then brings us to the in-year reports and the sections, the regulations that prescribe the in-year reports. Nothing particularly unusual in that regard. You then have Chapter 3, and essentially you're having the same provisions applying to municipal entities as applied to municipalities. There's some modifications. For instance, the approval of capital budgets isn't subject to the same restrictions as municipal budgets. But what we've indicated is that the capital programs of all municipal entities need to be submitted to the National Treasury. That's in terms of Regulation 42. The other regulations are almost a mirror image of those that are applied to municipalities. Then we come to Chapter 4, and what we have here is a process set out in the MFMA that requires the municipality to apply for extensions to any timelines that they see that they're not going to comply with. So, for instance, a municipality needs to table their budget on the 31st of March by the 31st of March for public consultation purposes. Now, if a municipality in preparing their budget see that, oh dear, we're not going to meet that deadline, then they need to apply for an extension to that deadline. Now, that application needs to go to the MEC for finance within a province. And the MEC needs to consider that. And what the MFMA requires a framework within which those political basis. And so Regulation 61, if you go with me to Regulation 61, it's on page 40, provides for that framework within which the MEC needs to exercise their oversight of these time frames. And then in instances where there's actual non-compliance, the municipality lost sight of the ball and the date came and went, and then they discovered that they hadn't complied with the timeline, then there are notifications for non-compliance, and there's a framework for the MEC to, within which the MEC needs to consider those notifications for non-compliance. Now, in each instance, one of the decisions that the MEC could take is to refer this for Section 136 intervention in terms of the MFMA. So that is one of the options. If it's a simple oversight, or if it's, you know, it's a non-material, then he can say he can condone it and it can proceed. However, there are certain deadlines that cannot be condoned. For instance, the deadline for the approval of the budget is fixed. It has to be approved by the beginning of the financial year, or before the beginning of the financial year. And there, the referrals to Section 136 intervention is automatic. Okay, then we come to the exciting topic of, I like to call it unforeseen and unforgivable expenditure, but it's, the official name is unavoidable expenditure, and that is in Section 71. We provide a definition there. And this definition is very important because it's the foundation on which unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure can be approved by council. If it falls outside of this definition, then it becomes unauthorized, irregular, or fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Okay, so it draws a dividing line between unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure, which is good because it means that the municipality is meeting its service delivery obligations, and irregular, unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless and wasteful expenditure, which is bad and needs to be investigated by the council. And so if you go through the definition, the important point is that there's two criteria that need to be met. Okay, the first one is Section 71A. It says that the expenditure could not have been foreseen at the time of the annual budget was passed by the municipality. In other words, that complies with the unforeseen component. It could not have been foreseen. And the name that we give to the expenditure is unforeseen and unavoidable. In other words, it needs to be unforeseen and unavoidable. So that sentence, if you look at it, and the detail in this particular regulation is very important, ends with an and. So it needs to be unforeseen, and it needs to then comply with the regulation 71(1)(b), which then stipulates the unavoidable component. And it's unavoidable because it will result in significant loss to the municipality, cause disruption or suspension or serious threat to the continuation of basic municipal services. It could lead to the loss of life or serious injury or significant damage to property, or obstruct the municipality from instituting urgent legal action. So, unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure can only be approved by the mayor and by council if it complies with both of these components of the definition. It must not have been foreseen at the time of the budget, and it is unavoidable because if this expenditure is not incurred, then some of these bad things could take place. Okay, and then in regulation 71.2, we give a list of kinds of expenditure that cannot be defined as unforeseen and unavoidable. So price increases of goods and services, new municipal services and functions during the financial year, extension of existing municipal services or functions during the financial year. All of that should have been part of the planning when the municipality was developing its IDP and its budget. So they should have been able to plan for all of those things contained in Regulation 71.2. Okay. We then have Regulation 72, which then also sets thresholds in terms of Section 29 of the Act.
Before you proceed, you see, don't you think 5 is a bit problematic there? 72, 5, Roman 5, discretionary.
Okay, you need to read it in context, Jay. In that allocating, it may not be allowed, it's not allowed to be used to allocate discretionary. So we're saying that that is not allowed. Okay. So I think it supports your view that it's problematic. Okay. Regulation 72 is similar to Regulation 13, in that it sets thresholds for unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure. In other words, a municipality may not exceed certain thresholds when it's dealing with unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure. Now the question arises, well, what happens if they do? And this arose with Cape Town Municipality in responding to the xenophobia disaster. And the answer to that is that any expenditure then becomes unauthorized, okay, and then needs to be investigated by a committee of the council. And that unauthorized expenditure that can then be authorized in terms of the budget. And so it's not leaving a municipal manager exposed in that their hands are tied, they can't respond to disasters. It just means that the funding or the approval for the funding needs to follow a more rigorous process. Okay, once they've exceeded these particular thresholds. And that's important. So you're giving them a little bit of leeway where the hurdle is not quite as high, and then once they exceed that threshold, then the hurdle becomes higher, and they need to provide better justification for that particular expenditure. Okay, and that brings us very nicely into Regulation 74, which then deals with the issues that council, that committee that sits to deal with unauthorized expenditure needs to consider. Okay, and this is very similar to the national process where the Standing Committee on Public Accounts considers unauthorized expenditure and then either condones it or does not condone it. And so the same criteria is being introduced here, and there's a measure of uniformity in the application of the regulations. And then the 75 and 76 simply deal with some gaps that there existed with regards to the condoning of irregular and fruitless and wasteful expenditure within the public entity environment. Okay, I'm now on slide 26, and this is I'm going to be looking now at three specific areas that we're seeking to address through these regulations. These regulations and the format deal with, it's very difficult to say how many areas, but they deal with a wide range of issues. But these are three very important areas that we've, let's say, paid specific attention to. And the first one is strengthening the oversight of infrastructure. It relates directly back to the analysis that we did with the Municipal Budgets and Expenditure Review, the work of Mali Jeng, and looking at the effectiveness of infrastructure spending through the MIG, but also through the other 70% of infrastructure budgets at a local government level. And so we've got three tables in the format that deal directly with infrastructure. Table A9, which is on page 121. Okay? And you'll see that we ask for fairly detailed information within the main budget regarding infrastructure. In other words, when the council approves the budget, they approve the infrastructure numbers that are contained in this particular table. And you'll see it covers new assets, renewal of existing assets, and then repairs and maintenance by assets category. We also look at the right at the bottom of that particular table, we're looking at particular ratios related to infrastructure. So percentage of capital expenditure on the renewal of assets. And this is dealing with the issues that Mali Jeng was previously referring to, is how do we get an overall perspective of the management of infrastructure within a municipality and ensure that it's being managed in an integrated manner. Then you go to table B9, and that deals with a very important issue, and that is the shifting of funds in year dealing with infrastructure. Okay? 143, page 143. And here when a municipality moves funds from one project to another, or from one area of infrastructure to another area of infrastructure. For instance, they move funding from the provision of water to the maintenance of roads. They need to show that shifting of funds transparently, and council needs to approve it as part of the adjustments budget. In other words, it's not just a management decision, or it's not a political decision disguised as a management decision. It needs to be explicitly brought to council so that any movement of funds during the implementation of the budget is done transparently. You'll also see that in that particular table, it provides for the multi-year approval of capital budgets. That if the implementation of the project is going well and they want to bring funding forward or bring budget forward in the current financial year, that they can do that, and that will lead to a consequential adjustment of the outer years of the MTF. So that is provided for. Similarly, if they want to delay a project, that has implications for the outer years of the MTF, and that all needs to be done transparently. Council processes are open processes, and there's an obligation on councils to communicate through their ward committees the decisions, well, the processes of council. There's also a provision that adjustments budgets must be tabled and published or placed in the public domain, so that these things aren't, let's say, done behind the closed doors of council. So yes, we have taken that into consideration. Obviously, the time frame for public consultation when one's dealing with an adjustments budget is far more limited than when one's dealing with the preparation of the overall budget. So that is a difficult dimension to provide for as adequately as one would like to, but we've sought to address the transparency issue through the regulations by requiring tabling, publication, and submission of the adjustments budgets to different role players. Okay, and then in addition to the three main tables dealing with infrastructure, there are a range of supporting tables. And the first one is supporting table 6, which deals with the reconciliation of the IDP objectives with the infrastructure budget. And so one wants to see a municipality detailing their strategic objectives, and then alongside that detailing how the budget speaks directly to those objectives. My boss was referring to the relationship between the IDP and the reporting against the spending of that IDP. And that is supporting table number 6 brings those two items directly in relation to each other. We then also have supporting table 34, which deals with the capital expenditure by asset class. There we're looking for a lot of detail that we want to know, not just that they're spending on roads, but we want to know the class of roads, the kinds of expenditure that are taking, whether it's renewal, maintenance, new infrastructure, and so on. No. These supporting tables aren't part of the regulations directly, but because they're supporting information that is required. The full set of tables, we've got a copy here for the committee of the full set of tables, but they also have been published on our website since June. So these are tables that, as it were, if I can illustrate it, you've got the 10 tables up top. And then in order to compile those 10 tables, there are another set of tables that are required. Okay? Now, those tables we have not prescribed. And the reason for not doing so is to maintain some flexibility in the system. That we may want, after implementing, we may want to say, this is working, that's not working, and then introduce some modifications. We also need to maintain flexibility given the next project is looking at the standard chart of accounts. So we may be making some changes to the standard chart of accounts definitions, which will impact upon some of the words and the line items contained in those supporting tables. They are public documents. In other words, a municipal council, when they table their budget, has to table all the supporting documents with that budget. Okay. The only difference between these tables and the prescribed tables is that these form part of the approved budget. In other words, if I place it in the national context, it's the difference between the appropriation bill, which is approved by Parliament, and the E&E, the Estimates of National Expenditure, which are tabled in Parliament but not approved. Okay, so in order to arrive at the appropriation bill, you need all the information that is contained in the Estimates of National Expenditure. And the same is here. So in essence, the 10 tables in the regulations are the appropriation bill for municipalities. They then have a set of supporting information that is provided in the supporting tables. Okay.
Just to interrupt you, these requirements are important requirements at the municipal level, but there are certain infrastructure projects that take place at a province or a national level. are there same, what you call, regulations perhaps that apply there? Because, you know, sometimes Parliament approves the budget to do this. A year down the line, that project has not been done. I do understand earlier Mr. Brown was saying maybe also our oversight system maybe is not tight to allow those kinds of things. But I'm just saying in writing, are there such regulations or do we intend to?
Essentially, service delivery happens at local municipalities. In other words, whether it is a province, whoever, finally it must happen there. And so that's the issue he's raising. So that in dealing with parachuting, and therefore the detail of the kind of project that you're looking for at a municipality, as if it was done by a municipality, what about this one? The school, the clinic, et cetera, that comes from a province, national department.
Now, Chief, perhaps I can respond because that was part of my sins working for the provincial part for the last, of the previous 8 years. So if you look at the budget documentation of provinces, the format that we prescribe, basically they have to list all the projects as well. So there's three dimensions. The first one is the services the department is responsible for. The second one is translating that information into the projects, and there's a list in each municipal and provincial budget where they have to list. And this is essentially the other part of Marajing's responsibility, to monitor that part of those implementation of those projects. Then we have started about 2.5 years ago a third dimension where the service delivery information not only translates into the projects but also to where the money is being spent, in which location. And Chair, if you ask the Treasury team that's responsible for the standard chart, the implementation, there's a dimension that we've introduced in the standard chart, what we refer to as the project locator. So not only can BAS now tell you where's the project, which projects are part of the budget, but they can also now translate that information where it's spent in which location. Now, this is the missing puzzle, the local government puzzle. So if all these puzzles is in place, then we can get consolidated picture for government, not only to say what we spent at national, provincial, local, but we can also start showing the dimensions for the projects and then is the location part. The only thing that's not there yet, and we can certainly introduce it, is if they have planned a project and they haven't delivered it, that's a new thing that we've, as a result of these lessons we've learned, introduced in the local government concept. But nothing stops us as a national treasury if that makes sense to also replicate it at the provincial context. Because at the end of the day, you would like to see that mirror and that overarching picture. How many schools is an education department intend to deliver and what actually transpired. Now, as part of managing's in-year reporting, the project part, we can now start getting that information from BAS from the spending perspective, and the non-financial information that the other component, Julinda's team, is putting in place, Chair, is to get the service delivery dimension. To do these things, unfortunately, it's very complicated because it doesn't happen overnight, but certainly we can explore if this is working in a local government context to start asking that for provinces as well. In fact, I think it's an excellent idea and we will take it back. The two provinces that has done quite extensive work, Chair, if you want to, and I can demonstrate it in their budget documentation, is Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng, Western Cape. Western Cape started about 2.5 years ago, then KwaZulu followed, and then Gauteng. And right at the back of their budget documents, you will see all these dimensions. And it's actually fascinating information, because then you know where the resources will be spent. But, Chair, I'm saying to put this in place is taking us a bit of time, that the system is also now helping us at the national provincial level, whereas in the past it was not possible. Thanks.
But still there's a gap, because there's this thing of math schools, for instance. That's a brand new thing. But then there's also the I was in another community in December. This gentleman had hijacked me to that community. Some road was built, and this community says to me, and it's something I just did not believe in the context of what I know about that province. Now they say, no, this road was built. It's not even about 2 km or 3 or 4 km. It was built because there was some little money that was left over in the provincial Department of Transport. And so this road does not link 2 cities or villages or 3 villages. It just ends somewhere in the middle of 1 village. Precisely because clearly there was no gazetting. But somebody felt that there was some change somewhere. And so they just decided to throw it there. So I'm saying, these are some of the funny problems that we think should be dealt with there. Proceed.
I'm sorry. And we've got an issue I'm dealing with the Department of Education in the Empangeni region, where a school budgeted for renovation. But then an agreement was made that they can just provide them with a library, some of the things, about 5 of them, and then agree that the other bit of money can be used for building classes elsewhere, so that it takes over another portion of the school that was not performing well. But now, when I go to the Department of Education, they just say the whole budget is going to go to the new school, and this old school is not going to have anything done for it. And people are up in arms, because now there is some unfairness, but I'm following it up with the Minister of Education right now.
No, there's something wrong somewhere there. And maybe there's also something wrong with the way you and the community are approaching this thing. No, no, let's see that.
The thing what happened in that area that you think about over the weekend,
I can't describe it. Is that so? Mr. Hutting?
Jay, I think what we have to do as the National Treasury is at one point ask the provincial team to take you through detail of what is in a provincial budget documents. Because if you say to the community, this is what you plan to do in your strat plan and it's been in the budget documents, then there must be expectation that there will be delivery. And if there's failure, then we can equip a committee with that type of information. Because that will add value to the process. And that's what I will arrange with Juliana to do, Chair.
Very proud. By the way, why don't you pick up some lunch here? There is some.
I was going to say we're approaching the end, so this the rest.
Okay, because there's also lunch here. I wanted you to pick up some lunch here.
Yeah.
It's finger lunch. So that whilst we're talking, we just talk while eating, but proceed and finish that.
Okay. And then you'll see the supporting table 36 asks for a detailed capital budget. We want to know the specific projects. And then SA 37 projects delayed from the previous financial year. So we want to get that in year or accountability from what was planned and what was delayed. Yes. Yeah. No, these, and also, you know, then the explanation to that supporting table needs to provide information on what was... Okay. You know, the reasons for the delay and things like that need to be done. The second area there where we're paying special attention is on strengthening conditional grant control. And we've got 3 supporting tables in that regard. We want municipalities to record the date on which they receive the money from the national or provincial departments. on their conditional grounds. We then want to reconcile that with the time when that money was spent. In other words, the date of receipt and the date of expenditure. Because if you're working in accrual accounting, it's only when the money is spent that you can record it as revenue within your budget. And so that's an important date. And then we want them to reconcile money received, money spent, to essentially write an IOU to either the provincial revenue fund or the national revenue fund. Because if that money is not spent by the end of the financial year, it needs to be returned to the revenue fund. Now, this is something that has not been implemented, or let's say enforced within the municipal context, which is why you have what the chair was referring to, which is accumulated funds in bank accounts. And this is going to provide a very strong incentive for municipalities to get on and spend conditional grant funding. Okay, and then the last big focus area of the regulations is on supporting the Municipal Property Rates Act. And this is at the particular request of DPLG in order to integrate the monitoring of financial matters relating to municipalities, that this has been brought into the into this, let's say, this regulation process. It's slide 28 on the presentation. And again, it's four supporting tables that we require municipalities to provide. One looks at the transparent reflection of the tax increases on property rates from one year to the next. The next two tables look at the current year's tax bill from property rates and the new budget year, so you can compare the two. This is for purposes of transparency. And then the last table is very interesting because it looks at the impact that the property rates increase will, and other service increases will have on households. So you have a large household bill, a small household bill, and then what's been added relative to what is currently required is a household that receives free basic services, and how the new indigence policy, the new tariff policy of a municipality impacts upon the bills that these different households will receive. Okay. Very quickly, I want to just take you through an overview of each of the, of the budget schedule. So if we could go back to page 53 in the regulations, you'll see that a budget essentially consists of two parts. Part A, and then the supporting documentation in part two. Okay, now this is where the analogy between the appropriation bill and the E&E is relevant. That part A is essentially the minister's speech on the budget, the parliament's resolutions on the budget, and then the appropriation bill. And that is, now you apply it to the municipal context, so it's the mayor's speech, that council's resolutions on the budget, and the appropriation bill, or the approval of the budget tables. And then part B is the E&E, it's the supporting documentation. And if you go through the list of supporting documentation, you'll see that there are a range of issues that are covered that deal with concerns that the community will have about the detail of the budget. And if you go through the entire document, you'll see that we require an enormous amount of detail for the council and the community to consider when they evaluate the budget. Okay. If we go to slide 35, The document you have before you is the Gazette that was published for public comment. That is running concurrently with the parliamentary scrutiny process that's required in terms of the MFMA. And we're looking at concluding these two processes by the 5th of March and then producing a final version of the regulations, taking the comments and the inputs that we receive into account so that we can hopefully promulgate the regulations by the end of March. So we're working to quite a tight timetable. The reason for targeting the end of March is to be able to prescribe the tables for the 27 municipalities that need to implement them by 1st of July. Now, they need to prepare their budgets in the format of those tables. So we need to give them we've already given them prior warning, but it's just emphasizing the warning that we're giving them. And then we're talking about target dates for implementation. We've adopted a phased approach. This is recognizing the limited capacity that exists, the differential capacity of the metros and the 21 large secondary cities and the smaller municipalities. However, what we have done is encouraged all municipalities to try to comply with the budget format in the upcoming financial year. And, for instance, the Western Cape, there's been a collective decision by the CFOs that they will all attempt to comply with the format. And that is very good news because, as we say, the formats are an end state. They're where we want to arrive at in a couple of years' time, okay, that all municipalities are working within these formats. So if municipalities start with the implementation now and they achieve, let's say, 60% compliance with the format, that means that when they have to implement it the following year, they've only got another 40% to sort out. And so we're looking at a phased implementation in that regard as well. We will, we're looking at a two-year implementation phasing, that 27 will comply this year, and then next year the rest of the municipalities will be required to comply. And in order to facilitate, I mean, we've already embarked upon a program of support. We've been to 8 of the 9 provinces. We've engaged with the vendors that supply the information systems to municipalities to get them on board so that they modify their systems in order to assist municipalities to collect the information. It's going to be an enormous amount of work. It's something that we as a team are looking forward to because we're actually excited by what these regulations are going to give us. I mean, the quality and the scope of the information is going to enable us to do the analysis work, to do the monitoring work just so much more effectively. If you take the fact that it took us nearly 14 months to compile a set of data in order to produce the municipal budget and expenditure review. If we have this system in place, we should be able to do that compilation of that information within 2 months. So 2 months after the beginning of the financial year of a municipality, we're able to produce a consolidated national picture of what municipalities are, where municipalities are spending their money. The implications of that for policy making, for oversight, for community participation in governance is just, one cannot, one can become very excited about it. Lastly, the last slide that provides you with a specific list of the 27 municipalities that will need to comply. Their names are actually gazetted in the second page of the document, page 4. And so to the extent that we can can make that official to compliance, that's been done. Thank you.
Now, this is very comprehensive, but well, it's good. It's good what the trader is saying, that they are being excited, because if these objectives are achieved, I'm sure everyone will rejoice with the result. However, with the implementation of now in our roadworks, we have discovered a number of things. The chairperson earlier spoke about planning, and where situation where the municipalities, I mean, we go there with provincial treasuries, provincial local government departments, but you find that not everybody knows exactly what is expected or what is the role of your provincial treasurer with respect to the what municipality are doing or the provincial department of local government. I'm not sure now in terms of these what you call extensive regulations. They are a good thing. What kind of support is there? I mean, every day we say that, what does Section 34 of Municipal Finance Management Act? It requires that you what you call I even know it now by the head now, because it requires that provincial government, national government must support municipalities. But in reality, it does not happen. And here, I mean, with this extensive, what you call it, work that is going to be required here, clearly, it means that you must go back to Mr. Brown, to your daughter now, and check whether your municipal budget are going to increase, because there is going to be administrative work that will be required in order to do this work. I hope that there will be support at that side, so that these municipalities, which eventually all municipalities will have to do this, there will be that work. Up to date, when we do the road work, we find that amongst the provincial, what they call the provinces, there's disparities in terms of support. One province, you find that treasury. National treasury as well, your provinces. I mean, your provinces are supposed to be having a direct, what you call, oversight, hands-on support. They do not have that capacity. You go around. How do we ensure that this succeeds in the period that you have, what you call it, for instance, you're having in mind to ensure that there is implementation? If you take the experience of implementation of your Municipal Finance Management Act, a lot of work had to be done to ensure that people are still struggling today. The complaints that you get there, that there's so much requirement, but what is really perhaps not there, whether it's in terms of your financial capacity of some of the municipalities, they can't provide everything. So how do we ensure that we succeed here? Because we need to succeed. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. This is quite exciting, because I think the people want to be as productive as possible, and to make sure that the country's economy is grown. But they do need a rope that is to be thrown into them so that they come out of the poverty pool. You know, this reference of being labeled the poor communities, people don't like it. And we do need to throw a lifeline rope to them. I would perhaps plead with the Treasury that they allow this Select Committee to make some studies don't think we can delegate this, to go to some countries where we can see how... Yeah, they must give us the money. To see how rural communities help themselves. You can go one to Germany, in Hanover.
That is executive, we are parliament.
Two, Wisconsin and Israel. To see how poor communities make it on their self-help project, and they actually contribute to the... Yes, I'm referring to it.
The lifeline is not relevant.
It is. Because without that, the poor communities will remain poor.
That is not relevant to what we are discussing. I'm going to rule you out now. Proceed.
I mean, if we are going to speak about rates to property rates to poor communities,
we already know about rights. We're not going to speak about rights. Mkhulu, lalela. Pensioners in this country know about these rates, and some of them pay them. So we're not going to talk about those. Can we speak? Oh, yes, they pay those. But can you talk to the content or anything that is in terms of the regulations before us?
See,
you have nothing? Well, Madam Robinson.
Okay.
You're not yet.
For now,
okay. Madam Robinson. No, no. This is the step we always say is in the devil is in the detail. Now Satan is staring at you now. Now,
where is
she? On the show. It's right here.
No, there is
Satan. Now, Mr. Barberton, let's go to that section 34 of the MFMA. And to the matter you're raising of the application to extend to the MEC. Look, this is really the problem. Because Section 34 is about exactly this cooperative governance issues. And so if that interaction is ongoing, MECs and everybody else would know. In other words, there would be no need for a mayor to make that application. Precisely because the interaction is kind of organic and dynamic, if you like. I'm just saying, what would be the relevance of Section 34 if, I mean, there's this ongoing engagement. I'm just saying, maybe you want to reinforce that, but I thought, in my view, Section 34 is really useful, because what it says, let's be hands-on all the time. And all the other cooperative governance clauses that you have in any piece of legislation are just about hands-on. And the issue that my colleague raises about structuring your units, for instance, in the provincial department of treasury, the local government, such that, I mean, the way they are structured, as long as there's some hands-on. You know, one of the things we've picked up is that whilst these people and units are in place, you find some people are just phoning to municipalities. They never go there physically. There's this municipality not far from here, the Northern Cape component, Sutherland and all of these municipalities. Roads are not the best of roads, and so people just phone. Now, in that context, there are problems of people not getting to the municipalities, for instance. I think that's the one thing that does worry me. If you want, therefore, to do this regulation, that applications, etc., and yet there's also this consideration that relates to about ensuring ongoing support. Now, what is missing that you are not talking about worries us? We have outlawed the discretionary fund in mayor's offices. But you don't seem to want to say something now in regulation. But there are other things now that they're bringing in, special projects in a mayor's office.
women's, youth, disabled, etc., those kinds of programs. How do we deal with that? Because I think it's a big problem there. The issues of it's a political kind of program. And they don't fund programs, if you like. These things are problematic there. I think it's something that we must find a way of handling in the context of this regulation. Because we also, as we raise it, you don't want to create this monster where a mayor just decides. For instance, part of the problem is that some of the mayors have a councillor in a mayor's office, something similar to a minister in the presidency. Problematic stuff. How do we then deal with that in this regulation? Secondly, there's this issue of donor funding. How do we deal with donor funding in the context of an IDP? It's a matter that I think needs attention. That's critical myself. I mean, if somebody throws 600 million at donor funding and there are no clear-cut guidelines in the context now of an IDP, and so what is this donor funding going to be doing in a municipality? Surely, in my view, it must supplement some of the programs that are there. But so how do we deal with it? Let's find a way of dealing with that. I've got to come back to the steering committee. And I thought the intention of the MFMA of removing councillors in the tendering process, noble, wonderful. But I think, again, unintentionally, we're opening some gap here in terms of the infrastructure person. I'm not sure this infrastructure person, is it a councillor or a manager? But there's another problem again, just going back to the IDP issue, where we thought the IDP process is a political process. And it becomes a technical thing now, because some municipalities are then expected to appoint IDP managers, etc., etc. And so I'm just saying it's a bit problematic there. No, if this is an IDP manager, well, I think it's a bit fine. I'm just worried about the CFO is fine for me. The councillor may call. Finance is a bit problematic for me. And the mayor. I think all the other people would be fine. I'm just saying. I did not think this through, but I'm just at face value now. I'm just saying, let's allow all these managers to do these things, deal with these things, and manage. And so that we create space for them to be able to do things. But if in a steering committee you then have politicians plus administrators, I'm not sure whether we really are doing the right thing. Over to you, Mr. Pillay, and your team. Or before that.
Small addition is the these regulations, we've seen them for the first time. And Mr. Babaton tried to go through them. I think that it's possible that I missed one. The regulations now, I think one thing that is good about them is that they're beginning to put time frames in terms of finalizing reports. And I think that one thing that it will assist us that we have found to be problematic is the fact that many municipalities over years, they sit there without anybody worried that the reports have not been submitted to the AG. Maybe this is going to be able also to close that gap to ensure that, because the AG there stands powerless, because it's waiting for a municipality to submit. Sometimes they submit, they withdraw the report, all those kinds of things. I hope that it tightens that what we call a path, so that there's no municipality that will not be able to submit an annual report. Thanks.
No, whilst they want to tighten, they open it up. And this is why they're giving a mayor some leeway to make an application for extension. I'm saying, well, you're right. Let's close that. You see, because the finance, Mr. Play says he's given you a calendar. But also the law is clear in terms of the time frames. Now, when we open up some leeways, again, people must be given this extension and that and that. But also in the context of a massive support program, I think it is problematic. Mr. Pillay.
Chair, thank you. Let me deal with two or three issues just on the bigger question. The steering committee concept was created through the need in the MFMA to require the mayor to play a political role and give political guidance. And that is the strategic thing we thought, by having the mayor and the councillor for finance who maybe delegated this responsibility, they will be able to deal with the strategic issues. So when a budget is tabled in council, the mayor can't say, I'm disowning this budget. It was prepared by officials. So I think that's the context in which we raise that. And we look very carefully at the people that need to form the base of this budget too, so that by bringing in the IDP manager can't say later, but there's something in the IDP that is not in the budget. That's where the debates around these issues need to take place, together with the mayor present. So it does reinforce that role. We think it wouldn't go in undermining the kind of the clear oversight responsibilities and separations of roles and responsibilities we try to put in place. So that would assist, we believe, in a more structured, collectively owned budget being tabled. So that's the one issue around the steering committee. The next issue is just around the provincial treasury capacity to support. In some provinces, they've developed a different model of support, which is addressing regional offices. So in the Northern Cape, there's three regional offices. In the Eastern Cape, there's also three regional offices of the provincial treasury, where there is support people in place. We need to do much more, though, to build the skills of the people in place, not to be the phone, just a rubber stamp on the pass-through of documents, but rather to be able to go and support. That will require perhaps an improved structure in the provincial treasuries to deal with the support. We are hosting another quarterly meeting of the MFMA coordinating team on the 11th and 12th of March, and we will raise this again at that meeting. We've raised it for the last 6 meetings, the similar issue, and I think we're starting to see the progress now. Many provincial treasuries are taking this seriously. They are appointing people in place. They're giving them a little bit more responsibilities. But some still are lagging behind, for sure. Some are definitely lagging behind. For example, in the Western Cape, there's probably 60 people working on the MFMA, as part-timers though, not full-time. 60, over 60 people do some responsibility under MFMA. And one can see definite progress being made there. In other provinces, definitely we need to. 60. Yes, correct. We are lucky to maybe find that number, which is correct. So we're working with them to build this in a way that we can deal with the matter. I think the committee had already allocated a little more resources to the financial management grant, and that will help. But again, it's not enough if you only have to rely on the grant to deliver on these. One must be honest and look at the issues. In some municipalities, definitely further resources are going to be required to fully implement all the reforms we have, not just this, the Property Rates Act and the Systems Act and the Structures Act. Some of the fundamental challenges in a municipality is precisely because those foundational legislation is not being implemented correctly. So we have the spin-off being shown more easily as non-compliance around the MFMA. So there's a link that we see. I think that's
just before you step off on that one, Tiva, I think it is going to be, and the member is correct, Member Sogoni. I think we will have to set some kind of a deadline to the treasuries themselves and say, look here, we can't be talking forever, actually, on this thing. By such and such a day, this is what we expect you to have.
if you don't have this, we have to take it up at a political level to be able to sort it out. But something else that we will possibly have to do as well is to look at what kind of capacity we would need to be able to implement this. I think it is something in the Treasury that we'll have to apply our minds on. And once we've got that, then we can bring the Treasuries on board in a very structured way and then take it forward.
Thanks, Chair. I think it's a reality, Chair, that there is capacity issues, and we know that as a Treasury. We're not blind to this. But at the same time, Chair, we are now in the fifth year of implementation of this little book. Now, my role in the Treasury in my previous life was to make this happen at the provincial level, and it took us 8 to 9 years. This reform is most probably going to take us the best part of 12 to 15 years to get it right. No. Chair, I'm saying to you, all this will be in place and work and running before I go into retirement. Now that means, as a Treasury official, there's a particular approach that we're going to take. And Chair, we are going to push very hard. As a Treasury, we're not going to accept the convenient excuses that there's not people, because they are officials, they are highly paid, and it's time for them now to come to the party. Our responsibility is to guide them and to support and hold their hands. But we're certainly not going to accept the position to say it cannot be done. And therefore, we're giving you our commitment that as a joint effort, and it's you can see it. Previously, it was Mr. TV Pillay and Company dealing with local government alone, the sole ranger. Now you've got at least 3 rangers sitting here. It's Marajeng, TV, and myself, plus others. And just to give you a sense, when we started in IGR to provide in this oversight role for provinces and municipalities, we were only 4 officials working in IGR. Today we are about 87 plus, and we're still exploring possibilities to provide dedicated support. So I'm saying, Chair, we are taking this very seriously, and if this works, a lot of other things will start falling into place. So it's not going to be an easy assignment, but our commitment is there to make this thing work. It doesn't matter what it takes. And there are surely going to be casualties in the process, because if people don't want to do the right thing, we will rather encourage them to get out of the system. Now, we also have developed these arts, Chair, and these levers in our experience in the Treasury, how to make these things happen. Now, we don't want to threaten people. That's not the business. We would like, as a Treasury, to be consultative, to be inclusive, and to really encourage people. But we are going to make this work. Doesn't matter what it takes. Thanks, Chair.
We're all being very... Yes.
What to raise was public entities also in the context of IDPs.
Yeah.
Johannesburg Water, etc., etc.
I think the first thing to emphasize is that all funding received by the municipality needs to be reflected on their budget. Okay, so the revenue is a comprehensive statement of revenue, so there are no little pools of money that are allowed to exist that the mayor has negotiated a donor that is going to be funding particular projects. Okay, so, and that is provided for in supporting table SA20, where we have the national government, provincial government, district municipalities that can all provide grants to local government, and then we've also got other grants providers, and that needs to be a comprehensive list of all the other grant funding that they receive. So that is included on the revenue side. The planning then for those, the use of that revenue needs to be comprehensive as well. So where we require information relation to the IDP. That needs to be a comprehensive statement of how that money is going to be spent, how the revenue is going to be spent. And so it must include the donor-funded projects, any projects being funded by other public entities, etc., where the money is transferred physically to the municipality. We are also using these regulations to close a specific loophole that existed in Section 12 of the Act. And if you go to actually Regulation 12, the coincidence in the numbering is by chance. It deals with the establishment of funds for charity or relief purposes. Now, we find that those funds have the potential to be abused because there isn't a requirement that the use of that funding needs to be approved by council. Okay. So what we are providing for in the regulations is that any transfer of money from the municipal revenue fund to those charitable funds needs to be captured in the budget or an adjustments budget. In other words, that flow of funding cannot happen in an unregulated fashion. It needs, in other words, it cannot be an informal flow, as it were. It needs to be captured and reflected in the budgets or the adjustments budget. So that is one loophole that we are closing down. As to our, let's say, scope to regulate, let's say, who manages projects, that is a little difficult. What we have indicated is that all information around projects needs to be transparently reported. And if it means that the project is located in the mayor's office, that needs to be reflected on table A9, that you'll have the vote for the mayor's office, and then you'll say, gee, but there are a lot of infrastructure projects under that particular vote. And then you'll have the vote for, let's say, the infrastructure department, and you'll have other infrastructure projects under that vote. Now, the question is, immediately as a sort of public person, why is it structured like that? And so by making this information transparently available, it enables, let's say, greater public participation around the location of the responsibility for these particular votes. We've gone through a number of drafts of this piece of legislation, and there was much that we wanted to do through these regulations. Unfortunately, we're confined by the legal requirement that you cannot regulate anything that is outside or is that additional to the confines of the Act. And so if the Act doesn't say it may be regulated, unfortunately, we cannot do that. And so with regards to the particular issue you're raising, it's one of those things that we very much wanted to regulate, but our lawyers indicated that that could be challenged and that it wouldn't be wise to include it. Well, it wouldn't be legal to include it in the particular regulations.
Look, I think we've got to take a step back now, because we have this wonderful review of the PFMA. And surely we can't delay the review of the MFMA. Mr. Brown challenges us to do some other things. And where I'm seated, that would be the first step to do, just to tighten the MFMA big time. And so I'm just appealing to you, if you think there are some areas that you think need to, not to, we amend it to refine it such that the areas you are raising are dealt with appropriately. We've got to deal with that. Now, there are interesting activities that take place at municipal levels. It has nothing to do with charitable organizations, etc. A mayor decides to, it has to do with spending. And funeral. There's no policy. For so-and-so's funeral, we're going to spend 180,000 rand. And then it creates a precedence, because now all the councillors would be watching this thing, Madam Robinson. All councillors, therefore, would be expected to be buried for 180,000 rand. This is spending. How do we deal with that? I'm talking a councillor. Now, on the other hand, you have a municipality, I'm not sure how many, but I know Makutu Tamaha has a funeral parlor. It's a municipality. Now, we understand the need, but it's not their core business. Now, how do we deal with that in the context of a regulation? Because clearly, and this is what we were saying in the Eastern Cape in our last visit, that once we understand these needs and problems, because provincial and national departments are not coming to the party, Sani District and many other districts, for instance, are digging deep into the equitable share and conditional grants, because the areas amongst themselves are poor. Sani has bought so many cattle and this and that for communities. It's not their core business. But how do we ensure that they don't do that? The municipality does it because they see it as a need. But unfortunately, it does not benefit the whole community. The act is clear. Whatever is done by a council must benefit the community, not a few individuals in a community. There are provincial departments that have to do those agricultural projects, if you like, and so on and so on, but they don't do them. Now, how do we then ensure that it is not a conditional grant I'm talking about? I'm talking about dipping into the equitable share of a municipality. Firstly, the district municipality does not even have own revenue, but they do then these things. I'm just citing now Krisani. And we were saying to them, these are things they should not do. Even if it is in the context of the LED, not what they should do. Buying so many cattle, creating agricultural food gardens, and so on and so on and so on and so on. It is not their core business. In that context, then, they compromise building of roads and other services. And so how do we assist them to do the right thing? Because it is not in the MFMA. The Systems Act is clear in terms of what they must do, but then broadly speaking, they've got to deal with this need of power. I'm just saying something that we need to want to look at, so that we then start nudging people to the right direction. Are we having a sitting? Everybody needs a seat. You know, when we start talking about these things, these are big things. We can even sacrifice eating. But I think that team wants to say something before Mr. Brown says something.
Chair, from my side, I just again want to... I'm not going to comment on your broad issues, because it's things that Mr. Brown will talk about. But again, thanks for the opportunity to listen to us, and we would be very interested in any specific comments that you would like us further to consider. But the opportunity, just to give you a feel of what it did take to get to this point, but it's one thing to get to this point, it's another thing to make it happen in reality, and this is going to be obviously the next challenge. Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Babatin and Mr. Brown.
Yeah, I just want to thank the committee and indicate that the purpose of the regulations is to bring transparency and accountability. And we've seen that at the national level, by placing information in the public domain, enables one to
counteract certain types of behavior that are unacceptable. And we trust that these regulations, by placing more comprehensive and ordered information in the public domain about the budget, will be able to address some of the issues. Not probably all of them, but certainly begin to address some of the issues that you raise.
Before Mr. Brown, Madam Maddy Jing. Manually. You're a scarce commodity this side of the
No, she's smiling because she says you. It looks like you are now really interested in infrastructure things, and you are stuck, and you are being converted. No, thanks, Chair and the committee, for affording us this opportunity to explain some of these things. I think when we've listened carefully, and I saw Jan taking and Sam taking quite notes. I mean, there are certain things that you've raised. We will still continue to look into those things. But I think we must also be very cautious that we can't regulate everything also. So that needs to be taken into account. But having said that, I think there's a particular responsibility that treasuries have, and yes, in national and provincial treasuries. Now, we've brought up this from outside national treasury. We've brought up our local government budget analysis unit. Because there's legislation that says these budgets must be tabled at a particular time, and then they must be submitted to us, and we must interrogate the budgets and then also provide comments on them. So the issues that you raise, in some cases, whilst we may not detect all of them, we must then, as treasuries, be able to, when we assess those budgets, be able to pick them up. Then we can submit you with reports, by the way, that says, we have analyzed the following budgets. These are the issues that we're picking up. We give them to you to be able, so that you can exercise your rights. But at the same time, treasuries at the provincial level must also be, they must also give themselves up to be able to do that. But if money is being spent irregularly, whether it's for a funeral for 180,000 and all of these things, if these things are, if we pick them up and they are not done according to book, of which we hope should not become a habit, we take action actually on it. We've picked up something through the Financial Intelligence Center of the Treasury, and we followed it up, and it has got its consequences now. You see, so where we pick up things as a treasury, we really don't push them under the carpet. We take them up there. I don't know, you guide us in terms of process really moving forward with this, and then, but thanks once again for the committee.
Okay, you see, we cannot, I'm not closing. Okay, say the last word.
I think that I like the challenge that Mr. Brown put to us. He threw it back, the contract back to us. And we have been saying ourselves, PFMA, that does not assist us. It's toothless. MFMA is not that bad, but as well. But PFMA, maybe in the review, does not really assist much. Not that we're doing enough as members of, as people who are charged with the responsibility of oversight. I think we're not doing enough. It's clear that we're not doing enough. But I like the challenge that you have put.
Look, you are right, Mr. Brown. You know, I say to some of the people I talk to, and this is what Mr. Sokoni loves saying all the time, we are where we are in terms of service delivery because it is our committees that are not working. That's the bottom line. Don't tell us about capacity and other things. The committees are not doing what they've got to do. They're not raising the right questions. That's just the bottom line. And it's even worse when we just decide to travel abroad when the country is burning. What is it that you want to go and look at in Germany when you know that there was so much money budgeted for this road and the road is not there? and then you want to take a trip to Germany. That's what he says all the time. And so clearly the challenge is accepted. It's appropriate. It's about what is it that we do ourselves as we engage. These reports, to what extent do we then accept these reports as credible, as proper? In fact, we also have an added advantage. We see these things, we go out there. These are our communities. Clearly. But then having then said that, we can also not... Mr. Brown, you say we should not regulate for everything. You see, the intentions of these laws are so noble. I love them. They're not about compelling people to do things. But surely you can't do these things and then wait for some good faith. People don't have good faith, unfortunately. And so what should we do? You know, when you grow a kid, you nurture the kid. For the kid to know that this is fire, it's burning, it's nice just to take the hand towards the fire so that she knows this thing is burning. And so let's find a way. But then as the system matured, we can unlock some of these things when we've seen that people, everybody's really doing the right thing. You know, this thing, conscientizing, must be some form. You must compel people to do the right things. Because if you don't and expect them to do them in good faith, we have, as I was saying, outlawed the discretionary funds. They find ways of innovation. And so let's really not allow chance takers to take chances. Because it does create problems. It goes back to the men and women that sit in your own offices. The laws are clear broadly, but then people would then wait to be reminded by yourselves, writing letters, emails, phones. I always have asked Mr. Pillay, what is the cost of reminding everybody? And who bears that cost? Because that money should have been used on other developments, in the same places, by the way. And so for me, I'm saying regulate and tighten everything. And when the system is ready and moving fine, let's unwind. I'm saying this on the basis of experiences. If you look at the report of the provincial departments in the last 2-3 quarters, it's gone down terribly. Why? Because we were focusing ourselves as a committee on municipalities. And we were thought provinces were performing better. And complacency crept in. Terrible performances by provinces. And so we must be on top of everybody all the time until it becomes a natural process. Now, having then said that, I think this was a useful engagement. In March, we shall be doing serious elections work. Would have been nice to suspend this discussion. But it cannot be suspended. It must proceed so that this must be finalized. And so I think what we shall do, we shall have to go through this, and I think broadly the regulations are fine broadly. And so they must be implemented. As we proceed, as we look at the MFMA in terms of its own workings, maybe in the next 5, 6, 7, 8 years, we might want to review it. That's where we shall pick up some of the gaps. But I think as is, it is broad enough. But then, minus the issues that Mr. Barberton says, your legal advisors are saying, well, because the law is not saying, at least I think that's the area we might want to come back to in the next parliament. What are these things that are creating problems for us to implement? This hymn book is beautiful. You know, part of what we have picked up in our discussions in the context of complying with this hymn book is what was raised by Heguruleni, section 14. And I suspect there's a huge problem of land corruption, of not complying with section 14. Surely we've got to come back to that discussion for all the municipalities we've dealt with. All of them, let's come back to Section 40, without exception. We've got to find a way of dealing with the issue of land corruption, so that we unlock land for development for municipalities. Let's thank everybody for as usual, the good inputs that you've given us, and invite all of you to have some finger lunch. And I'm happy that all of you are not really in a big rush for lunch today.
And just take
one video
for campaigning.
Mam Kun. There is something called
political party.